You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Best of Flashpoints for the week of May 4th, 2018. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the program, we speak with author and Roots Action co-founder Norman Solomon, who explains how the ghosts of new Democrats are haunting us. Also, with the passing of May Day, we celebrate the work of migrants and undocumented people who do the hardest work in this country. We'll speak with Pablo Alvarado, executive director of Endilon, who discusses the struggles to protect these vulnerable workers and protect their families. And later, we'll feature a report from the border where U.S. officials continue to break the law by denying fleeing refugees their right to apply for asylum. All this straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We kick off today's show with an interview with author and Roots Action co-founder Norman Solomon, who explains how the ghosts of new Democrats are haunting us.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Delighted to have in studio with me Norman Solomon. Norman Solomon is the founder, co-founder of Roots Action. He's an author of many interesting books, and he's an activist, and he's busy now taking on the Democratic Party. Norman, your new article is called it's called The Ghosts of New Democrats Are Haunting Us. Tell us about who the ghosts are and who the new Democrats are who are being haunted or haunting us.
The past is not really past, as Faulkner said. And here we are in 2018, and you can look back at the last 25 years, and hidden in the recesses of what we don't get from mass media is the reality that while we've had these horrendous Republican presidents in the last few decades, Reagan, two Bushes, now this awful, nightmarish administration of Donald Trump, we've had 16 years of Democrats in the White House. And when we look at what occurred beginning 25 years ago when Bill Clinton entered the Oval Office, we can really see that the corporatization of public policy and government stance towards labor and towards working and wannabe working people on the one hand and corporate America and Wall Street on the other, these have had decimating effects, and that both Clinton and Obama stocked their cabinets with Wall Streeters, with investment bankers, with those who in their various ways really undermined the relationship between the Democratic Party and the working class. And we're seeing the results now. It has helped the right wing enable, supercharged the right wingers, the racists, the misogynists, the nativists, the anti-immigrant forces. And it has undercut our possibilities to build strong progressive movements that can be reflected in electoral results.
I mean, a lot has gone on, and there's a lot going on now. There's a poll out. I came out today out of New Hampshire that has somebody who is very popular as an alleged progressive, Elizabeth Warren. Give us sort of your sense of where the Democratic Party is now, and are they going to? Is there going to be any way to penetrate the Clinton failures that left us where we are now? And it is, in large part, the Clinton Democrats that killed our progressive movement or put it on hold for about three decades.
There's no doubt that Clintonism, so to speak, is surviving the individuals with Clinton as their last names, Bill and Hillary. And so the Democratic National Committee, the leadership, as it's called, I use the term advisedly, but the leadership of Schumer and Pelosi in the Senate and House, the Democrats, these are folks who are corporately oriented. They advance the sort of line that there are victims without victimizers. You know, there are many people suffering, disproportionately people of color and women, the feminization of poverty, but many under the gun economically, and they are victims. And yet, according to the storyline coming from the top of the Democratic Party nationally, there are no victimizers, i.e., other than blaming Republicans, the role of Wall Street is pretty much jumped over and evaded. I think as progressives, as we look at all political work, including the necessary electoral tasks ahead, it's really important to keep in mind the two overarching imperatives. One is to fight the right wing and all that it represents in terms of the class redistribution of wealth upwards, the assorted bigotries and injustices that come with the right-wing agenda. That has to be fought unequivocally. And at the same time, we need to advance a genuinely progressive agenda, not a faux, fake, supposed progressive agenda, pseudo-populism. You know, anybody can call themselves progressive. There's an insurance company that calls itself progressive. It doesn't make it progressive. And so a lot of times, especially in this awful Trump political era, people understandably might think, and listening to us right now, oh, well, that's well and good, but we have to defeat the right wing, the Republican control of Congress and Trump, et cetera. Of course we do, but it's clear that simply thinking along left-right term and therefore the country has moved right, so we've got to move to the center, is absolutely wrong. I think that's an insight that Bernie Sanders has continued to bring forward and the supporters have been doing, that if you want to fight the right-wing corporate juggernaut and that pseudo-fake populism, what you've got to do is enable genuine progressive populism, because people are furious. Young people don't see a future generally. A lot of folks see the health care expenses going through the roof, sending their kids to college, astronomical costs, all the rest of it. People are feeling financially very, very stressed and pessimistic about the future. And the way to address that is not to support a status quo or say go back to the Obama years that brought us to this juncture, but to say we need to develop an affirmative progressive agenda so that the only opponents of the status quo aren't the right wingers, that we offer a genuine alternative that's not complacent. And the Clinton campaign of 2016 reeked of complacency, and we got the electoral result.
And there's now deep resentment within the progressive community with those folks who could be Democrats based on the way that Bernie Sanders was treated. We hear a lot about, was it a leak or a hack of Democratic headquarters? But the question is, what did those emails say? What were the Democrats up to? How did they undermine brutally Bernie Sanders? What happened to the possibility of a progressive agenda, and who's responsible?
As somebody who is elected as a Bernie Sanders delegate from California to the Democratic National Convention, I felt like, I think really millions of Bernie supporters, that clearly, as evidence has borne out, the Democratic National Committee was not, as it's supposed to, according to charter, behaving in an even-handed way during the primary process of 2016. Well, now as we look ahead, I think a fundamental question, and it's something that I addressed in my article you mentioned that appeared on the Truth Dig website yesterday and is on Common Dreams today, is that can there be democracy inside the Democratic Party? There is not. The superdelegate issue, the way that more than one in seven delegates were party officials who were almost all establishment, as it happened, almost all lined up behind Clinton, half of the superdelegates had declared for Clinton before a single vote was cast in a primary or caucus. We have this reality that the Democratic Party hierarchy and establishment, which is very corporate and very militaristic, make no mistake about it, as reflected in the cabinets of the Obama administration and the Clinton administration before it. They fear democracy inside the party. And that's why they want to retain superdelegates. That's why they're trying to, so to speak, keep the riffraff out of the controlled environment of the Democratic National Committee. I mean, I went to the DNC offices and had a meeting with the senior advisor of the chair of the DNC, Tom Perez, 6 months ago. I accompanied Karen Bernal, who's a wonderful, strong activist chair of the Progressive Caucus of the California Democratic Party. And I felt as if we were entering a hermetically sealed container called the DNC. It is cut off from grassroots organizing or activism. And whatever you think of the wisdom of that, the proof is in the pudding. You know, I wrote a piece in August of 2016 that appeared in the Hill newspaper, and I drew on the latest authoritative poll, and I pointed out that at that point, among the 18 to 29-year-olds, if they determined the results of the 2016 general election, then Gary Johnson would have gotten more votes than Hillary Clinton. That was already clearly the extent of anger and alienation among young people towards the nominee of the Democratic Party and the party establishment in general. And, Dennis, there's a poll just in the last few days here now, in spring of 2018, that there's been a marked fall-off in support among young voters towards the Democratic Party just in the last year. So let's get with it. And here's one more example. I mean, that's, I think, the message of the report that I worked on called Autopsy, a Democratic Party in Crisis, which is online at democraticautopsy.org. Let's get with it, those who want to use an electoral instrument called the Democratic Party to defeat the right wing and advance a progressive agenda. We've got to get beyond this antiquated, ridiculous, I'm in the club and we'd better stay in our club sort of attitude coming from the Clintons. And I'll give you a quick example of the Clinton forces, which still unfortunately dominate the DNC. Hillary Clinton, in promoting her book a few months ago, went on television and said, "What's with Bernie Sanders? He's not even a Democrat. Why is he mucking around in our party if he's not going to be a member of the Democratic Party?" And this is precisely the wrong attitude. It is it's sort of like saying, maybe some days we'll have telephones that won't have to be attached to the wall. It is like half a century behind the realities that, as our autopsy report pointed out, for every registered Democrat, there are more than two independents, or what in California we call declined estate. So you have a diminishing club called registered Democrats, and you have the top of the party officials saying, "Well, gee, if you're not a registered Democrat, we don't even respect you. We're not going to defer to you. You're not in our club." That's a born loser of an attitude.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we're speaking with Norman Solomon. His most recent piece, Common Dreams, up on Common Dreams today, is called "The Ghosts of New Democrats Are Haunting Us." Now, Norman, in your piece, I just take slightly issue. You're saying that the Democrats are a little less bad than the Republicans. Now, I should note in this sort of comment, Bill Press, a noted Democrat, is recognized that maybe Donald Trump should get the Nobel Peace Prize if he brings that deal and that peace treaty together in the Koreas, ends the Korean War. Finally, that would equal him, such as Kissinger won a Nobel Prize and Botha in South Africa won a Nobel Prize. So I don't know which is worse at this point. I don't know if Hillary was elected with her no-fly zone in Syria, we would have been in World War III with Russia. Maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah, I think, Dennis, if you look at or you ask people directly affected, the policies of the Trump administration in terms of immigration, for instance, in terms of the flagrant racism reflected in policy, in terms of, you know, Eric Holder, who I had major criticism of, compared to this neo-fascist named Jeff Sessions running the Justice Department, the appointment to the Supreme Court we've already suffered under, moving the court rightward. I mean, these are awful choices between corporate warlike Democrats and corporate warlike Republicans. But I think on balance, if you ask informed, for instance, people of color, who's affecting your life worse, they would say a Trump administration than an Obama administration. But that said, the corporatization and militarization of policy under the Clinton-Obama administrations, you know, we're still getting emails from the DNC, wish Barack a happy birthday. I'd rather not. I'd rather wish a happy birthday to the victims of the economic policies that sunk For instance, their houses underwater that Obama refused to help. So if you look at this pattern, this is a pattern. If we're going to stop the right wing from controlling our governments and enact genuinely progressive policies, it's a pattern we got to break. Clinton becomes president. He pushes NAFTA through. He pushes welfare reform, which was a misogynist and racist assault, reflected in the effects on disproportionately women and people of color who were damaged by this so-called reform of welfare. NAFTA, an assault on working people, the benefit of corporations. And then you fast forward to the Obama administration, and he bailed out the banks. He didn't bail out working people, again, disproportionately people of color affected by subprime mortgage ripoffs and scandals. And Dennis, you documented in real time what the reality was of the biggest patron and bankroller of the Obama political career, and that was Penny Pritzker. More than $2 billion in wealth, was his main financial backer, victimized so many people. And I linked to your article in Counterpunch in my piece out today on Common Dreams. We have this reality that, okay, it's not just flagrantly immoral and despicable that Democrats have pursued these policies. It's also an economic travesty and terrible injustice, and it's also an electoral loser. So even if people are immoral about all the rest of it, this kind of fealty to Wall Street is a gift from Democrats to these Republican right-wing demagogues.
Yeah, it is interesting that Penny Pritzker, for crashing an SNL for $1 billion and getting Obama elected, she becomes Secretary of Commerce, was it?
Yeah, and so of all the people in the world to make Secretary of Commerce, just Obama happens to choose somebody who made financially his political career possible.
And shall we say, she set the standard, led the way in terms of these so-called subprime loans and the packaging of loans. That was her baby. You track that one down. That's a whole other history. Norman, given the problems we have with our two parties here and our two-party system, isn't it time to really seriously consider a third party?
I think we got to look at the terrain, and the place where that's most fruitful, I think, is in elections where there's no party named on the ballot, the what are known as nonpartisan races. And I'll give you an example. Progressives have made huge gains in the city of Richmond, California, which has been oppressed by environmental racism coming from Chevron for decades and decades. And we've had through the Richmond Progressive Alliance one triumph after another. Now a 5-2 majority on the city council has held for most of the last decade and more through Gail McLaughlin, who's now running for lieutenant governor as an independent, has held the mayor's office. And we have now, as a sort of an outgrowth of that grassroots organizing, which doesn't care really if you're registered Green, Democrat, Independent, Peace and Freedom, whatever, we've got two campaigns coming up right now for the early June ballot. We have Jovanka Beckles, who's running for Assembly. She's a wonderful activist, progressive, wonderfully effective at the Richmond
City
level.
So you're saying at the local level, at the...
But that's now going to the state legislature. Right. She's choosing to run as a Democrat, fine. Melvin Willis, who I've heard speak, also a very powerful grassroots organizer, elected a couple of years ago to the Richmond City Council. Now he's running for mayor of Richmond. So there's tremendous possibilities there. When it comes to the national level, we've got to, I think, be realistic. Feet on the ground, eyes on the horizon. When is the last time that any non-Democrat progressive was elected to the U.S. Congress or a federal post in general? Well, let's see. There's Bernie Sanders, and that's about it in terms of progressives who pulled it off. So I go back to something that an old Chinese strategist said centuries ago. When you're engaged in a struggle with an adversary, don't do what you most want to do. Do what your adversary least wants you to do. And frankly, I would most want to bail out of the Democratic Party. The meetings are boring. There's so much to feel uncomfortable with and discouraged by. But at a tactical level, our adversaries, the military-industrial complex, I believe they want us to leave the Democratic Party to the corporate and military forces, and we should not benefit those forces by absenting ourselves. We've got to struggle for control of the party.
That's Norman Solomon. His latest piece, again, The Ghosts of New Democrats Are Haunting Us. That's up at Common Dreams now. It's you can find it a lot of places. Norman, we thank you as always, co-director, co-founder, I should say, of Roots Action. Many good books. Thanks for joining us again on Flashpoints.
Thank you, Dennis.
Listening to the best of Flashpoints for the week of May 5th, 2018. My name is Mike Biggs. Up next, we feature a report earlier this week from the border where U.S. officials continue to break the law by denying fleeing refugees the right to apply for asylum.
We go right to the U.S.-Mexico border, where we're joined by Alex Mensing. He has been working closely with the caravan. You remember the caravan coming full of Hondurans fleeing violence in their homeland, and the same caravan that Donald Trump threatened to call out the army to defend against. It is an amazing moment, but they are being denied their rights to apply for asylum. Is that correct, Alex Mensing? Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Dennis. And that's right. There's a group of approximately 150 asylum seekers here outside the port of entry. I'm right across the street from where they've set up an encampment right now because the entire group was told that nobody will enter right now. They were told this by U.S. Customs and Border Protection officials because the port of entry is at capacity and they have no way of processing any more asylum seekers right now. That's what they're being told. And we've been going up and asking Customs and Border Protection officers repeatedly, and they've continued to say the same thing, sometimes citing various reasons and sometimes refusing to say anything more specific.
They're at capacity, huh? But this is a legal right that folks fleeing violence can apply for asylum. They have a right, so they're being denied their legal rights by the United States government, correct?
Absolutely. The U.S. government is committing a crime by turning people away who are encountering U.S. immigration agents who are expressing a fear of returning to their home country. At that point, according to Title 8, Section 1225 of the U.S. Federal Code, the officer must refer them to either an asylum officer or an immigration judge, who's the person who can actually make a determination about the validity of their asylum claim. But what's happening right here is that they're walking up to a port of entry and they're being told to go away. That's exactly what's being told to them. And the capacity issue, to be perfectly honest, is completely ridiculous. The idea that one of the most powerful police forces in the entire country is incapable of processing 150 refugees when they're capable of transporting and detaining and incarcerating thousands of people every single day is just outrageous.
Now we understand that the other side of that is the brutality in terms of when folks are, there are many ways to deny their rights. They could be arrested, have their family split up, brutalized, treated in such a fashion that they want to go home. Is that your understanding, that there are brutalities that have happened to others who have applied in the past?
Absolutely, and are continuing to happen. The U.S. government is waging a war on refugees, and these are refugees who are fleeing their countries, in many cases, because of the effect of U.S. foreign policy. They come here, the United States takes their children away. There was a member of the refugee caravan from last year, last fall, whose one-year-old son was taken from him. And his father is still in immigration detention today, and his son was in a government shelter for 3 months before he was able to get out. They're continuing to do that. There was recently a report that reported that over 700 cases of children being taken from their parents by immigration agents have happened. They're also completely doing away with the right to parole. An asylum seeker who arrives at a port of entry, which is a legal process, you show up without documents, but if you're fleeing for country, it's not a crime to come ask for asylum. That's a protection under international agreements that the United States has signed and under U.S. law. And the detention, the incarceration of asylum seekers under international agreements should be a last resort. And ICE's own policy says that somebody who shows up at a port of entry, passes a credible fear interview, and is not a security risk or a flight risk should be released. But there's proof now that over 90% of requests for parole from many ICE jurisdictions are being arbitrarily denied.
If there was any justice in this world and for these folks fleeing this violence, they would have been able to link up, be greeted, processed, and be with those folks, those hundreds of folks who marched down from Los Angeles to greet them on the other side of the fence. Could you talk about what happened in terms of their initial meeting? I know they sort of met between the fence between them. Could you describe that situation?
Yeah, so on Sunday morning, before the group walked to the port of entry, they first went to where the border meets the beach. There are two fences set up there by the U.S. government. And from one side to the other, they set up speakers. This March Without Borders, people who came marching from Los Angeles to San Diego in solidarity to greet the caravan, met there at the same time. They played music, a song that was composed by one of the members of the refugee caravan about the caravan. They sang chants that they had learned together, that the March Without Borders had learned from the caravan members, and chanted on their way to San Diego. It was beautiful. And the contrast between that greeting and the denial of their rights at the port of entry by the U.S. government is very stark, and it's very, very frustrating for people. It's frustrating, but luckily they're not losing hope. They are organizing. They're refusing to leave this space where they have put together their own security commission. They're taking care of food, people from San Diego.
So they're camped out. So they're camped out. Yep. Set the scene. So they're camped out outside the point of entry. They're setting up camps, tents. What's it look like? Tell us about that.
So I'm looking at it right now, and you can see this sort of heavily militarized set of fencing, a very, very long metal hallway that takes you to the port of entry, and these tourniquets in these large fences, and this small plaza outside, this sort of small open area outside this large port of entry building. And in that small area, there are now tents set up, tarps, like the kinds of that you would see people selling food out of. There's people cooking, they're serving food, there are people, there's blankets that people have brought, people from the community are coming to talk to them to learn about what's happening, and in fact right now they're organizing for a press conference because they just read the statement that was given by Vice President Pence today in Mexicali, and they're going to respond to some of the lies that Pence has been saying about them in the caravan.
Could you sum up Pence's attitude and what he said?
Yeah, basically he's accusing some members of the caravan of being criminals, and then that they're victims he's saying that the members of the caravan were exploited and manipulated by open border activists for political purposes, and that they're essentially just being taken here by people not because they were fleeing violence. And when they heard that, they erupted. They were outraged. In fact, one of the mothers grabbed the megaphone right away and said, "Nobody told me to leave my country. I decided to leave my country to save my child's life." And that's what hopefully they're going to clear up right now about what is behind this. These are refugees who are fleeing a situation in Central America that is getting worse and worse every day. The Honduran government is repressing people who are peacefully protesting. And the group here is a testament to that. This is not a group of people who are trying to game the system. This is not a group of people who have been manipulated. This is a group of refugees who have organized themselves, who are participating in a movement of refugees, and who are standing up for their own rights. And that's precisely why the U.S. government is afraid of them. That's precisely why for 3 days the U.S. government has not let a single asylum seeker into the port of entry at San Ysidro, which is absolutely unconscionable.
And if you could give us an example of one person who you've met to give us a sense of what they're thinking, what they're feeling, whose story would you tell us?
There's a woman who is just helping organize here. Her name is Linda. She's from El Salvador. Unfortunately, because of threats against her children, she chose to leave. And she has been one of the people who has helped organize all along the way. I remember when we were in Puebla, wondering whether or not the refugee caravan would be able to continue because the Trump administration was pressuring the Mexican government to stop it. We were talking about this, and she stood up and she said, "On behalf of all the mothers here, whether or not you are able to continue going with us, we have to stay organized. We need to maintain our collective power so we can protect ourselves, because when we left southern Mexico, where we had fled to, and joined the caravan, we joined it so that we wouldn't have to suffer the kinds of abuses, sexual assaults, kidnappings that people suffer on this route. And so there's no way that we're going to disband. We're going to keep fighting together, and we're going to go all the way to where we feel we can be safe by requesting asylum in the United States." And here she is. She's still fighting here with her kids. And she's been a very, very important key member of the team here on the refugee caravan.
Okay, so you all will be camping there until these folks are granted their rights? Is that it?
Until the U.S. government decides to stop breaking the law by denying them access to the asylum system.
And how do people get more information? How, if they want to know more, if they want to watch it perhaps on YouTube or see what's going on or support it or go down there, how do they get information?
A good place to get updates is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Pueblo, PueblosF, or you can go to Pueblo Sin Fronteras, PueblosinFronteras, PueblosinFronteras.org.
You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Finally, we close today's show with an interview with Pablo Alvarado, executive director of Endilon, who discusses the struggles to protect those vulnerable workers and their families as we celebrate May Day.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gavilan Molina, and we are delighted and honored to be joined again by Pablo Alvarado. He's executive director of Endilon, National Day Laborers Organizing Network. Pablo Alvarado, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Let's start at the border. Trump has been at it with the Twitter all morning. He's already called out the troops. He's continuing to attack brown communities who are fleeing the violence that the United States caused. Let's get your initial reaction to this situation.
Well, it's a humanitarian situation that we have at the U.S.-Mexico border. And, these are people who are fleeing from violence. And at the very least, they should be given the right to tell their story in front of a judge, right to share what they've gone through in their countries of origin. If there is a legitimate fear and a legitimate persecution, our country should open up the doors, for people who are fleeing violence and extreme situations of repression and persecution.
Yeah, well, instead of giving a hearing, they're being given handcuffs and a prison sentence.
Which is very unfortunate, and they're being pressed with criminal charges instead of again opening up the asylum system where people can come in and tell their stories. That's what it should be, but that's not what's happening right now, unfortunately.
And one of the things that is happening that we're seeing, Pablo, in this human rights crisis, there's a human rights crisis at the border with these families, a lot of women and children, coming to the so-called land of the free, land of liberty and justice for all. But in reality, and particularly this day, May Day, International Workers Day, we're seeing the situation at the U.S.-Mexican border in Tijuana. These refugees fleeing from the violence that was created by U.S. foreign policy, in Central America, in Mexico in the last 20, 30 years, has caused this massive migration. And here we are, not even responding to it, criminalizing these people that are in fear for their lives. What recourse can we find today? We provide people coming, they're providing labor, they're providing cheap, sources of labor for this country to create the living conditions of comfort that people find in California throughout the U.S. by, people coming to work here. And now they're criminalized. What recourse do people have here? Is there any way, to fight back? Any way to push back? We know California's passed legislation. We know that the governor has taken a stance. We know these, legal mechanics are set up to protect people. But even with that being in place, we're seeing people arrested. We're seeing people criminalized. What can people do at this point, Pablo?
Well, at this point, we have to assess the situation that's happening there. What I know is from reports from the ground there is that there are kids who are sick. There are mothers who are not doing very well. And that I know that 8 people were admitted for credible fears interviews. And I don't know what the strategy of the organizers is, but what I know is that people do have the right to at least that credible, that interview of credible fear, where they can come in and tell their stories. And I think I think that there might be some volunteers. I just got back from El Salvador, and I haven't been fully briefed about the situation there, but what I know is that that there are some volunteer attorneys trying to provide guidance to the members of the caravan. So we'll be assessing the situation and see what can be done. Maybe, but if there are lawyers, this is what people need. People need representation right now, and if there are volunteer lawyers that can mobilize to the border right now and talk to people and assist people, that's exactly what people need right now. And yes, you are right. This is happening on Labor Day, International Workers' Day, when we honor the value of labor and the folks that are at the U.S.-Mexico border, before being migrants, they are workers. And workers' rights should not end at the U.S.-Mexico border. Workers' rights should extend across the board, you know. And today, millions of people mobilize around the world saying that workers must have a voice at the workplace and beyond. So this is what's happening. So we'll be, again, you know, assessing that in a more detailed manner, the situation there.
That's the voice of Pablo Alvarado. He is the executive director of the National Day Laborers Organizing Network. That's Endelon. He deals a lot with workers, undocumented workers, and the incredible struggle going on at that level. But before we talk more about workers on Labor Day, you say you're just back from El Salvador, where many of the people are fleeing from. How would you describe the situation on the ground? Could you have any information about what might help us understand why people are leaving their country, like you did?
It's very simple.
They say the earthquake is over, so everybody can go home.
Yes, look, wages and working conditions are terrible. And if you improve wages and working conditions, people will not be forced to leave. In addition to that, there is a crisis of security in the country, where there are entire pockets of the population that are under the control of gang members. And these are young, misguided young people who are harming their own communities. And the intervention there is not like killing them. It's not repressing them, which is what's happening there. There are you know, death squads that are actually going after people who have tattoos, even if they are artistic tattoos. You know, people get killed over there for having those tattoos. So El Salvador people are migrating because of there are multicultural circumstances. You know, some people are leaving because of violence, some people are leaving because of extreme poverty, and some people are leaving because they're members of transnational families and they want to come together, they want to integrate the families. But the reason why people are living nowadays is multicultural, you know. So, but for as long as workers, you know, earn miserable wages and have terrible working conditions, people will continue migrating. A peasant makes between $5 to $7 a day. The price of gasoline is exactly the same as the United States. The price of meat, the price of milk is exactly as it is in the United States. Now, you name it. Earning, you know, $5, $7 a day and having a family of three or four people, you can't make it under those circumstances, you know. But that is exactly why people are leaving El Salvador. And Honduras is even worse right now because there's a lack of governability right now. There is a presence that has been imposed, by this country essentially, and by the Organization of American States and the European Unions. When they are, you know, turning their blind eye to the situation, they're not forcing the administration of Juan Orlando Hernández to essentially, you know, do new elections. The Organization of American States already said that the only way to fix the situation is by having, again, elections, you know, and that so far he's refused. And instead of doing it, he has engaged in persecution, in repression, and going after people who are defending in the street what they want in the polls, you know. So this is exactly what's happening in Honduras, and the violence and the poverty continues. That's why the vast majority of people who came in the caravan, I know that at the end it was about 200 people who made it to the U.S.-Mexico border, but originally it was about 1,500 people, and the majority of them came from Honduras because the crisis there, the instability is worse than in the other countries.
All right, Pablo, let's talk a little bit more about the people you represent and what the struggle is on the ground. We don't hear much about this on the corporate networks. They're into Russiagate. You got people like Brian Williams. He's sort of a blow-dried liar. People don't remember that he got thrown out initially from the media because he was lying about being under danger in Iraq. But he's now not telling the truth about much other than, you know, talking to a few reporters in the White House about what Trump did lately. But why don't you give us an assessment, remind people who you represent, and give us an assessment of their struggle on the ground now. It is May Day.
Today is May Day, and I can tell you that whenever any person walks around a neighborhood and you see the beautiful green gardens and you see the houses painted, well-cleaned, you see people going to work, you know, in good jobs, and you see, you know, kids going to school, you have to ask the question, who makes all of that possible? And it's essentially the most humble workers that you can think of, actually, who the ones who make this country run. The reason why the people, the bureaucrats who work in the banks in downtown Los Angeles or in downtown San Francisco, you know, that reason why they go to work without any concern is because there's someone taking care of their kids, because there is someone mowing their lawn, because there is someone painting their homes, you know. And that labor is usually invisible, not just the labor, but people themselves. Because at the same time, you know, that everyone enjoys the fruits of workers' labor, at the same time, people refuse to accept the humanity. Actually, this country refuses to accept the humanity of the 12 million undocumented people who live in this country, who every day toil in the fields, in the restaurants, in the construction sites, you name it. Undocumented, you find undocumented labor in any industry, but there are some industries that fully depend on migrant labor. And it's invisible. And the only way to accept people's humanity is by granting them their rights, giving them, making them visible. You know, in the case of undocumented people, giving them the ability to have documents. In the case of all workers, it's given the ability to have a voice, to have a union, to have a worker organization that represents them. And this country has forgotten that democracy depends on workers having a voice at the workplace. And now, because there is an employer running the country, everybody, all employers feel emboldened to exploit workers, you know, fail to pay their wages, fail to recognize their voice, fail to accept that they need to be represented by a union or by a worker organization. You know, and this is a reality that workers face every single day. Everybody enjoys, friends and foes enjoy the fruits of people's labor, but people, society in general, refuses to accept the people's humanity. And that has to change. And that is why my organization exists, to protect a segment of workers who are in vulnerable circumstances. And these organizations must be supported, and these workers must be recognized.
Say more about Endelon. Again, Dennis Bernstein, in a moment, Miguel has another question for you. But just remind people what the structure is.
Yes, well, Endelon is the National Day Laborers Organizing Network, and we bring together about 50 community organizations that work with day laborers in different capacities. We have built about 70 day laborer worker centers. These are dignified and safe spaces where workers gather to wait for their employers. And when employers come, there is somebody facilitating the negotiations between workers and employers. So when workers and employers reach an agreement, they go out there and it's transparent, you know, and we make sure that if employers fail to pay people's wages, we know where they are. If a worker doesn't do his or her job well, the employer knows where that worker is. So it's a win-win situation, and we need more of this worker run organizations across the country, because it's the only way that you can protect workers. It's the only way that workers can find a collective voice and fight for their rights. You know, when they have their organization, when they are represented, when they are trained as leaders, when they speak for themselves. And this is exactly what this country needs in this moment of when the gig economy is flourishing more and more, and the gig economy is essentially, you know, takes away the responsibility of employers to ensure that workers have at least workers' comp, that workers have, you know, that they're paid what they are owed, because otherwise, you know, our country will be full of independent contractors, misclassification of workers, and that only ends up in the further exploitation of workers who are in vulnerable circumstances. That has to change, and that's why our organizations are essential. That's why our unions and worker centers are essential for democracy. It's not even just for workers, it's for democracy, especially in this moment when fascism is taking over.
Not just taking over, but we have a supremacist White House who has targeted California and targeted, you know, the brown population in this country. And recently, Pablo, we saw just, in the last few days, where the Board of Supervisors of San Diego County voted to not abide by the sanctuary state and the rule of law that has been set out by California to protect the undocumented community. And you have the pockets over in Orange County that are, again, resisting, you know, the laws pushed forward here in the state to protect the undocumented communities. So we have these pockets of areas in California who are very affluent, very rich. People live in, you know, sometimes opulent lifestyles, fancy foods, the California cuisines, the fine wines, the craft handcrafted beers, all of that. Well, who are the labor force that creates all of that? As you were mentioning, Pablo, it's the undocumented worker. It's the migrant worker that's providing the labor to give the California lifestyle to the famous and the rich. But yet, it's those communities as Orange County and San Diego that are saying no to sanctuary. We want the National Guard. We want the ICE to come and take all these people out of here. So it's this massive contradiction and this lack of making the connection that the lifestyle that California has provided for the middle class, upper middle class, the affluent, and the rich has been at the expense of migrant undocumented labor. What at this point, Labor Day today, we celebrate, you know, workers, international workers everywhere. But here in California, there's a long way to go before workers, and not just, you know, it's at a place now to, in some areas, Pablo, whether you're a citizen or not, documented or not, you're suspect. So there's this tension of fear, you know, has been created. And you're right, it's going to take the people coming together, organizing from the ground level, whether you're documented or not. It's going to take students organizing themselves, bringing other people that normally wouldn't be involved to stop what is happening, because it's spreading. You know, every day we see the president of this country getting more bolder and bolder. We see, you know, other, you know, officials, you know, policymakers emboldened by the racist rhetoric. And that is the pushback, I think, that workers and organizations like yourself are doing. But there's also a sense of, is there any hope? What can we look at in the future here for this next year, between now and next Labor Day, International Labor Day?
Yes. Well, there is hope. You know, I can tell you that today we opened a new worker center in Charlotte, North Carolina, where a church opened up their premises to allow workers to come in and hang out and wait for their potential employers in the premises. And these are the people who are doing this are Americans, U.S. citizens. And at the same time that you have people who don't recognize, you know, the fruits of people's labor, there are folks that do. And fortunately, that's, you know, that's what the nature of our country, you know. In moments of turbulence, there are always people who come out. In moments where which is a handful of people are exploiting the fears, you know, that this country is going through profound demographic changes. For the first time in a generation, the future people, Americans are figuring out that the future generations of Americans will not be better than the prior generations of Americans. And you can feel it. And there are some people who stoke those fears, who use those fears, you know, to promote an agenda of hatred and racism and bigotry and division and, marginalization and further polarization of society. There are people who are taking advantage of those moments. But at the same time, you know, we have to understand that the fear that a segment of the white, a very small segment of the white community feels of losing their status of majority, it's the same fear that the slave owners faced when the slaves wanted to be free. And that changed. It's the same fear that men felt when women were fighting to earn the right to vote. It's the same fear. And that went away as well. It's the same fear that George Wallace faced when the fight to desegregate America was taking place. And that there was progress made at that time, you know. So there are these, America and our country has gone through those changes, and we always surface above. And what I know is that this administration is pushing for short-term goals. But the arch of history, as Martin Luther King said, they always bend towards justice. And we might be going through a difficult time right now for humble people. But I can tell you that humble people, and there are some, will rise up. And so will, people who believe in justice. And there are millions of people. I would say that the vast majority of Americans are people who believe in justice, who believe in democracy, who believe that people should be given second chances, who believe that that this country should continue to be, you know, that place where the huddled masses who are yearning to be free, to be free, can actually come and make their case to become U.S. citizens. You know, there are a lot of people who believe in that, in that kind of America. You know, and I think like that's what we need to focus on, making sure that more Americans believe that what's happening is wrong and that they need to act. You know, I know for sure that my organization and those day laborers who are engaged in my organization will continue to fight, you know, for what is right, for what is fair. But I see moments of darkness right now, but I see light at the end of the tunnel, and that will depend on what we do and how we peacefully fight back against, you know, these attacks that we haven't seen in a generation.
Pablo Alvarado, I'm going to do a public nomination here. I want to nominate you for the Nobel Peace Prize, and I'm damn serious. Because the work that you've done for workers, for the people, for all of the people in this country, because you're providing a humane atmosphere for people to work, allows them to go to work in a way in which they can be really good workers. And this mutual respect really is contagious. So they say kindness is contagious. It's more than that. But you are a kind visionary, and we appreciate having you again, Pablo. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
All right. Take care now.
And happy May Day.
Happy May Day.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, we continue our look at where America is going and how we can stop it from going there, with part two of a fine talk by Chris Hedges. I hope you'll stay tuned. The new year often inspires thoughtful people to take a look back at the recent past. It also inspires idiots to do the same. And the corporate world's propaganda shills love a look back at the glories of America's consumer culture during the past year. Here's a retrospective by AP's cub reporter Jocelyn Novick via My Provincial Daily Newspaper. It's called The Year in Pop Culture. Just to pick a month more or less at random, here are the important cultural events of July. A collective awe ricochets round the world as Britain's mediagenic royal couple, William and Kate, release photos of the equally mediagenic Prince George upon his first birthday. Turns out his fashion choices, lots of blues and bib overalls, prove as influential as his mom's. Laverne Cox, meanwhile, is nominated for an Emmy, the first nomination for an openly transgender person. It's also time for the campy movie Sharknado 2. So much for July 2014. And thank you, Associated Press. It's news analyses like these that are beginning to give prostitution a bad name, beginning to give brainwashing and distracting the electorate a bad name. And if July sounds like a bad month for American culture, you'll definitely want to avoid this article's write-up on December, which discusses at length the size of Kim Kardashian's bottom. In this year's AP News recap of Popular Culture 2014, there is plenty about staged events in the corporate media, and not a word about the spontaneous, huge, mass demonstrations against police brutality in Ferguson, Missouri, which inspired many similar demonstrations all over the world. Apparently, anything popular that originates from the people doesn't count as popular culture to our corporate news media. How about the mass protests and die-ins that followed the police killing of Eric Garner in New York? How about the now famous slogan that so beautifully summed up popular rage and frustration against a repressive system? I can't breathe. An advertising agency didn't create that slogan. The people did. And it's now on 500,000 t-shirts. Sorry, the corporate media don't consider that popular culture. Kim Kardashian's bottom is popular culture. Well, for a better job of taking a look back at recent history, we turn to Chris Hedges. Hedges thinks that our ruling elite are making great progress in turning our country into a banana republic. We'll pick up his talk where we left off last week. After some more indictment of the current system, Hedges considers what to do. The only solution he sees is massive nonviolent rebellion. I don't know the name Hedges gave to this talk. I'm calling it The Myth of Progress, The Necessity of Rebellion. With part two, Here is Chris Hedges.
The only place left for us is on the street. We must occupy state and federal offices. We must foment general strikes. We must be willing to accept the discomfort of arrest and jail. The elite, with no check left on their greed and criminality, are gorging on money while they are slashing basic services, budgets for schools, firefighters, and assistance programs for children and the elderly. So we will pay for the fraud they committed when they wiped out $14 trillion of housing, wealth, wages, and retirement savings. We now live in Orwell's Oceania, not Huxley's The World State. And the inculcation of fear, the pernicious ideology of permanent war, has left us clamoring for our own enslavement. Like the residents of Oceania, we forgot that terrorism is a tactic, one that has been with us since Sallust wrote about it in the Jugurthine Wars. And you cannot make war against a tactic. Terrorists are defeated by isolating them within their own societies. And after 9/11, we had garnered the empathy of not only the world, but the Muslim world, where I was reporting at the time for the New York Times. Muslims were appalled at what had been carried out in the name of their religion. Sheikh Tantawi, the chief Islamic authority in the Sunni Muslim world, denounced the attacks of 9/11 as a crime against humanity, which they were, and Osama bin Laden as a fraud, someone who had no religious training or authority to issue religious edicts or fatwas. And if we had had the courage to be vulnerable, to build on this empathy, rather than dropping iron fragmentation bombs all over the Middle East, we would be far safer and more secure today. But we drank deep from the very dark elixir of nationalism, that toxic brew of self-exaltation and racism, that elevation of ourselves and denigration of others, and at that moment embraced the evil we set out to fight. We widened our occupation of Muslim land across the Middle East, unleashed proxy wars in Yemen and Pakistan, turned our backs on the brutal assaults by Israel against the Palestinians and Lebanese, and chose to speak to the Muslim world exclusively in the language of violence. Terrorism against us will not end until the state terrorism we practice on Muslim land ends. We began this cycle of hate, and only we can end it. The torture of Private Bradley Manning mirrors the torture of the dissident Winston Smith at the end of 1984. Manning, held as a maximum custody detainee, spends 23 hours of every 24 hours alone. He is denied exercise. He cannot have a pillow or sheets for his bed. Army doctors have been plying him with antidepressants, the cruder forms of torture practiced by the Gestapo have been refined by our Orwellian techniques, many developed by government psychologists, to psychologically destroy human beings. We break souls as well as bodies. It is more effective. And by breaking dissidents like Manning, who expose the war crimes we are committing in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, it sends a message to all who contemplate defying state power. We can all end up in Orwell's dreaded Room 101. We can all be made compliant and harmless. These special administrative measures are now routinely imposed on dissidents, including Syed Fahad Hashmi, who was imprisoned under these conditions for 3 years before ever going to trial. Thousands of detainees in our black sites across the globe experience these forms of scientific torture daily, as do those in our maximum security prisons, where the state makes war on our most politically astute underclass, African Americans. We once had Huxley's world state with its easy credit, consumerism, and mass-produced junk. But that was only a temporary diversion, as we were cleverly stripped of personal and political power. Now that the credit has dried up, the mass-produced goods are no longer cheap, and our ability to make a decent standard of living is gone. We get Orwell's naked iron fist. The noose is tightening. The era of amusement is being replaced by the era of repression. Tens of millions of citizens have their emails, phone records, all communication turned over to the government. We are the most monitored and spied on citizenry in human history. Our daily routines are caught on dozens of security cameras. Our proclivities and habits are recorded on the internet. Our profiles are electronically generated. Our bodies are patted down at airports and filmed by scanners. And public service announcements, car inspection stickers, and public transportation posters constantly urge us to report suspicious activity. Public space has been privatized by corporations who use security systems to prevent public expressions of discontent and remind us that we are nothing more than their consumers. The enemy, we are told, is everywhere. Those who do not comply with the security dictates of the war on terror, a war which, as Orwell noted, is endless, are silenced. The draconian security measures used to cripple protests at the G20 gatherings in Pittsburgh and Toronto were wildly disproportionate for the level of street activity. But they sent, like the torture of Manning, a clear message. Do not try this. The FBI's targeting of anti-war and Palestinian activists, which saw agents raid homes in Minneapolis and Chicago, is a harbinger of what is to come for all who dare to defy the state's official newspeak. Do you begin to see, then, what kind of world we are creating, Orwell wrote. It is the exact opposite of the stupid, hedonistic utopias that the old reformers imagined. A world of fear and treachery and torment. A world of trampling and being trampled upon. A world which will grow not less, but more merciless as it refines itself. Acts of resistance in the face of evil are moral acts. They are carried out because people of conscience can no longer tolerate abuse and despotism. They are carried out not because they are effective or even practical in a utilitarian sense, but because they are right. Those who begin these acts are few in number. They are dismissed by the cynics who hide their fear behind their worldliness. Resistance, at its core, is about affirming life in a world dominated by corporate systems of death, and resistance is the supreme act of faith, the highest form of spirituality. It is time for us to choose whose side we are on, who we will stand with as our civilization unravels, the hungry and the suffering, who already comprise half of our globe, are becoming as familiar to us as our own underclass. And it is time to accept that to live in the fullest sense of the word, to exist as a free and independent human being, means open rebellion and a constant defiance of all centers of established power, including the Democratic Party. Cast your whole vote, not a strip of paper merely, but your whole influence, Thoreau wrote in Civil Disobedience, after going to jail for refusing to pay his taxes during the Mexican-American War. A minority is powerless when it conforms to the majority. It is not even a minority then, but is irresistible when it clogs by its whole weight. those who recognize the injustice of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, who concede that these wars are not only a violation of international law, but under post-Nuremberg laws defined as criminal wars of aggression, yet continue to support politicians, including Barack Obama, who fund and advance these wars, have forfeited their rights as citizens. By allowing the status quo to go unchallenged from Wall Street to Baghdad, they become agents of injustice. To do nothing is to do something. And those who profess a love of democracy and justice, but who continue to cooperate with these established power structures, practice a false morality. They vent against war and the corporate state, but do not actually resist. They take refuge in the conception of themselves as practical men and women, as realists, as moderates. They stand on what they insist is the middle ground without realizing that the middle ground has shifted under us and the old paradigm of left and right, liberal and conservative, is meaningless in a world where, to quote Immanuel Kant, all of our structures of power have embraced a radical evil. This timidity, this failure to act, is the worst form of moral cowardice. It cripples and destroys us. When Dante enters the city of woes in the Inferno, he hears the cries of those whose lives earned neither honor nor bad fame, those rejected by heaven and hell, those who dedicated their lives solely to the pursuit of happiness. And these are all the good people, the ones who never made a fuss, who filled their lives with vain and often empty pursuits, harmless, no doubt, to amuse themselves, who never took a stand for anything, never risked anything, who went along. They never looked too hard at their lives, never felt the need to look, never wanted to look. As long as we remain paralyzed by fear, and fear of the other is the only thing Obama and the Democratic Party intends now to offer us, we will continue to be disempowered and impoverished. To resist while there is still time has become a moral imperative. It must be carried out, not because it will or won't work. I'm not naive enough to promise you that it will. But because it is right, we cannot use the word hope if we do not actively resist, if we are not willing to make hope visible. Courage, as Aristotle wrote, is the highest of human virtues, because without it, we are unlikely to practice any other virtue. And once we find this courage, we find freedom. Camus argued that we are separated from each other. Our lives, he wrote, are meaningless. We cannot finally influence fate. We will all die. Our individual being will be obliterated. And yet, Camus wrote, one of the only coherent philosophical positions is revolt. It is a constant confrontation between man and his obscurity. It is not an aspiration, for it is devoid of hope. That revolt is the certainty of a crushing fate without the resignation that ought to accompany it. A living man can be enslaved and reduced to the historic condition of an object, Camus warned. But if he dies in refusing to be enslaved, he reaffirms the existence of another kind of human nature which refuses to be classified as an object. The rebel, for Camus, always stands with the oppressed, the unemployed, the sick, the homeless, the one of four children in this country who depend on food stamps to eat, the Palestinians in Gaza, the frightened families in Iraq and Afghanistan, the disappeared who are held in our global black sites, the legions of poor in our inner cities and oppressed rural communities, undocumented workers, those in our prison system. To stand with them does not permit us to collaborate with institutions such as the Democrats, who mouth the words of justice while carrying out acts of oppression. It means open and direct defiance and often very lonely acts of revolt. The power structure and its liberal apologists dismiss the rebel as counterproductive. They condemn the rebel for refusing to compromise on justice. The elites and their apologists call for calm and patience. They use the hypocritical language of tolerance, compromise, generosity, and compassion to argue that the only alternative is to work and accept systems of power that long ago abandoned these virtues. The rebel, however, is beholden to a moral commitment that makes it impossible to stand with the power elite. The rebel refuses to be bought off with foundation grants, invitations to the White House, television appearances, book contracts, academic appointments, or empty rhetoric. The rebel is not concerned with self-promotion or a career or public opinion. The rebel knows that, as Augustine wrote, hope has two beautiful daughters, anger and courage. Anger at the way things are and courage to see that they do not remain the way they are. The rebel is aware that virtue in the wider society is not rewarded. The act of rebellion defines itself. And in these acts of rebellion, especially when they are carried out against monolithic forces of power, we see human majesty. You do not become a dissident just because you decide one day to take up this most unusual career, Václav Havel said when he battled the communist regime in Czechoslovakia. You are thrown into it by your personal sense of responsibility, combined with a complex set of external circumstances. You are cast out of the existing structures and placed in a position of conflict with them. It begins as an attempt to do your work well and ends with being branded an enemy of the state. The dissident does not operate in the realm of genuine power at all. He is not seeking power. He has no desire for office and does not gather votes. He does not attempt to charm the public. He offers nothing and promises nothing. He can offer, if anything, only his own skin. And he offers it solely because he has no other way of affirming the truth he stands for. His actions simply articulate his dignity as a citizen, regardless of the cost. The capacity to exercise moral autonomy, the capacity to refuse to cooperate, offers us the only route left to personal freedom and a life with meaning. Rebellion is its own justification. And those of us who come out of the religious left have no quarrel with Camus. Camus is right about the absurdity of existence, right about finding worth in acts of rebellion rather than some bizarre dream of an afterlife or Sunday school fantasy that God rewards the just and the good. O my soul, the ancient Greek poet Pindar wrote, do not aspire to immortal life, but exhaust the limits of the possible. We differ with Camus only in that we have faith that rebellion is not ultimately meaningless. Rebellion allows us to be free and independent human beings, but rebellion also, I believe, chips away, however imperceptibly, at the edifice of the oppressor and sustains the dim flames of hope, empathy, justice, and love. And in moments of profound human despair, these flames are never insignificant. They keep alive the capacity to be human. We must become, as Camus said, so absolutely free that existence is an act of rebellion. And those who do not rebel in our age of totalitarian capitalism, those who convince themselves that there is no alternative to collaboration, commit spiritual and moral suicide. Alexander Herzen speaking a century ago to a group of anarchists about how to overthrow the Tsar, reminded his listeners that it was not their job to save a dying system, but to replace it. "We think we are the doctors," he said. "We are the disease. All resistance must recognize that the body politic and global capitalism are dying, and we should stop wasting energy trying to reform or appeal to it. This does not mean the end of resistance, but it does mean very different forms of resistance. It means turning our energies towards building sustainable communities to weather the coming crisis, since we will be unable to survive and resist without a cooperative effort. It means acceptance that this struggle for justice will outlive us, that every value we fight for may be diminished when our own lives draw to a close, but external reality cannot be the yardstick for how we measure the moral life. Our mediocre and bankrupt elite is desperately trying to save a system that cannot be saved, and more importantly, they are trying to save themselves. All attempts to work within this decayed system and this class of power brokers will prove useless. And resistance must respond to the harsh new reality of a global capitalist order that will cling to power through ever-mounting forms of brutal and overt repression. Once credit dries up for the average citizen, once massive joblessness creates a permanent and enraged underclass, and the cheap manufactured goods that are the opiates of our commodity culture vanish, we will evolve, I expect, into a system that more closely resembles classical totalitarianism. Cruder, more violent forms of oppression will have to be employed as the softer mechanisms of control, favored by what the philosopher Sheldon Wolin calls our system of inverted totalitarianism breakdown. We cannot allow ourselves to surrender to the dehumanizing ideology of totalitarian capitalism. Acts of resistance which keep alive another narrative empower others, who we may never meet, to stand up and carry the flame we pass to them. And I know of what I speak. It was my father's life of defiance, his fight as a Presbyterian minister for racial equality, against war, and finally his outspoken defense of gay rights, positions that sabotaged his own career and drove him out of pulpit after pulpit that set every single standard by which I measure my own life. It is my voice tonight that you hear, but these are his words. And in the Christian faith, we call this resurrection. Thank you.
And with Billy Bragg's song, Unwelcome Guest, starting to fade up, we end part two of a fine talk by Chris Hedges. I think he gave the talk in 2011. A video of the talk appeared online just this summer, and Robin Upton nicely edited the audio for radio broadcast. And I have snipped out just another minute or two. For more of Robin's good work, go to unwelcomeguests.net. And for more of our own work, check out newworldnotes.blogspot.com. This is Kenneth Doust. Illegitimae non carborundum. Please tune in again next week, and insofar as possible, have a good new year. Ciao.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. On today's show, you'll hear about data collection and surveillance of us all, which has been justified by 9/11 and the ensuing bogus and endless global war on terror. And you'll also hear about censorship of social and alternative media by the same companies that are collecting all the data on all of us. So let's begin with this audio clip by James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com, discussing the military-industrial complex and the newer information industrial complex. So here he is, the highly informative James Corbett.
When World War II ended and the American deep state welded the national security establishment into place with the National Security Act, the world entered into a new era, the era of the military-industrial complex. But when the Cold War ended and the clash of civilizations became the new existential threat, the deep state found an opening for another paradigm shift. As the all-pervasive threat of terrorism became the carte blanche for total surveillance, the powers that shouldn't be found the organizing principle of our age would not be military hardware, but data itself. Welcome to the age of the information industrial complex. Of all the things that President Dwight D. Eisenhower did during his years in office, it is for a single phrase from his farewell address that he is best remembered today, the military-industrial complex.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist.
It is not difficult to see why these words passed so quickly into the political lexicon. Think of their explanatory power. Why did the U.S. use inflated estimates of Russian military capabilities to justify stockpiling a nuclear arsenal that was more than sufficient to destroy the planet several times over? The military-industrial complex. Why did America send 50,000 of its own to fight and die in the jungles of Vietnam, killing untold millions of Vietnamese, not to mention Cambodians? The military-industrial complex. Why did the U.S. use the public's fear and anger over 9/11 and a phony panic over non-existent weapons of mass destruction to justify the illegal invasion and trillion-dollar occupation of Iraq? The military-industrial complex. Why did Nobel Peace Prize laureate Obama expand the fictitious war on terror into Pakistan and Yemen and Somalia, refuse to close Guantanamo despite his earlier promises to the contrary, commit U.S. forces to kinetic military action in Libya without so much as seeking congressional approval, and launch a new era of covert drone warfare? The military-industrial complex. Why has Trump not only continued but further expanded the U.S. military presence in Africa, increased U.S. aid to Israel and Saudi Arabia, actively enabled the war crimes in Yemen that have led to the largest cholera outbreak in human history, and killed more civilians in his first 6 months in office than former Drone King Obama killed in his entire 8-year presidency? The military-industrial complex. When you think about it, it's rather remarkable that such a phrase was ever uttered by a president of the United States, much less a former 5-star general. Could you imagine any modern-day president talking about something like the military-industrial complex and its attempted acquisition of unwarranted influence without immediately dismissing the idea as a conspiracy theory? Over the decades, there has been much speculation about Eisenhower's use of the phrase and what precisely he was warning against. Some have argued that the phrase was prompted by Eisenhower's discovery that the Rand Corporation was grossly misrepresenting the Soviets' military capabilities to John F. Kennedy, who ended up using the Rand-invented and completely fictitious missile gap threat as a cornerstone of his 1960 presidential election campaign. Whatever the case, it is perhaps time to revisit Eisenhower's most famous speech. What Eisenhower is ultimately describing is the rise of American fascism, the merger of government and corporate power. What term can better capture the nature of early 21st century American political life? Is there any longer any doubt that the military-industrial complex has reached its ultimate expression in firms like Blackwater, aka Xi, aka Academy, and its military contractor brethren? Is there any other word but fascism to describe a state of affairs when a Secretary of Defense can commission a study from a private contractor to examine whether the U.S. military should be using more private contractors, only for that same Secretary of Defense to leave office and become president of the company that conducted the study, only to leave that company to become vice president of the U.S. and begin waging a war that relies heavily on no-bid contracts awarded to that same company based on the recommendation that it made in its original study? Yet this is precisely the case of Dick Cheney and Halliburton. It would be difficult to think of a more blatant example of the military-industrial complex fascism that Eisenhower was warning of. But as it turns out, there was another warning about fascism embedded in that farewell address that has received far less attention than the military-industrial complex formulation, perhaps because there is no catchphrase hook to describe it.
Today, the solitary inventor, tinkering in his shop, has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists in laboratories and testing fields. In the same fashion, the free university, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research, partly because of the huge costs involved. A government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. For every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of new electronic computers.
Given that this warning came in 1961, before the age of communication satellites or personal computers or the internet, it was a remarkably prescient observation. If scientific research half a century ago was dominated by federal grants and expensive computer equipment, how much more true is that for us today, half a century later? So what is the problem with this? As Ike explained,
yet in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite.
Here again, the warning is of fascism. But instead of the military-industrial fascism that dominated so much of the 20th century, he was describing here a new fascistic paradigm that was but barely visible at the time that he gave his address. A scientific-technological one. Once again, the threat is that the industry that grows up around this government-sponsored activity will, just like the military-industrial complex, begin to take over and shape the actions of that same government. In this case, the warning is not one of bombs and bullets, but bits and bytes. Not tanks and fighter jets, but hard drives and routers. Today we know this new fascism by its innocuous-sounding title, Big Data, but in keeping with the spirit of Eisenhower's remarks, perhaps it would be more fitting to call it the Information Industrial Complex. The concept of an Information Industrial Complex holds equally explanatory power for our current day and age as the Military Industrial Complex hypothesis held in Eisenhower's time. Why is a company like Google going to such lengths to capture, track, and database all information on the planet? The Information Industrial Complex. Why were all major telecom providers and internet service providers mandated by federal law to hardwire in backdoor access to American intelligence agencies for the purpose of spying on all electronic communications? The Information Industrial Complex. Why would government after government around the world target encryption as a key threat to their national security? And why would banker after banker call for Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies to be banned, even as they plan to set up their own central bank-administered digital currencies? The Information Industrial Complex. The effects of this synthesis are more and more felt in our everyday lives. Every single day, hundreds of millions of people around the world are interfacing with Microsoft software or Apple hardware or Amazon cloud services running on chips and processors supplied by Intel or other Silicon Valley stalwarts. Google has become so ubiquitous that its very name has become a verb meaning to search for something on the internet. The 21st century version of the American dream is encapsulated in the story of Mark Zuckerberg, a typical Harvard whiz kid whose atypical rise to the status of multi-billionaire was enabled by a social networking tool by the name of Facebook that he developed. But how many people know the flip side of this coin? The one that demonstrates the pervasive government influence in shaping and directing these companies' rise to success, and the company's efforts to aid the government in collecting data on its own citizens? How many know, for instance, that Google has a publicly acknowledged relationship with the NSA? Or that a federal judge has ruled that the public does not have the right to know the details of that relationship? Or that Google Earth was originally the brainchild of Keyhole Inc., a company that was set up by the CIA's own venture capital firm, InQtel, using satellite data harvested from government Keyhole-class reconnaissance satellites? Or that the former CEO of InQtel, Gilman Louie, sat on the board of the National Venture Capital Association with Jim Breyer, head of Excel Partners, who provided $12 million of seed money for Facebook? Or that in 1999, a backdoor for NSA access was discovered in Microsoft's Windows operating system source code? Or that Apple founder Steve Jobs was granted security clearance by the Department of Defense for still undisclosed reasons while heading Pixar in 1988, as was the former head of AT&T and numerous others in the tech industry? The connections between the IT world and the government's military and intelligence apparatus run deep. In fact, the development of the IT industry is intimately intertwined with the U.S. Air Force, the Department of Defense, and its various branches, including, famously, DARPA, and, of course, the CIA. A cursory glance at the history of the rise of companies like MITRE Corporation, Oracle, and other household electronics and software firms should suffice to expose the extent of these relations and the existence of what we might dub an information industrial complex. But what does this mean? What are the ramifications of such a relationship? Although the signs have been there for decades, perhaps the most startling example of what lies at the heart of this relationship has been revealed by the whistleblowers at the heart of the National Security Agency, one of the most secretive arms of the American intelligence apparatus. While Edward Snowden has received the most attention with his revelation of the PRISM program, much of the information about the NSA's ability to surveil all electronic communications has been revealed over the past decade by NSA whistleblowers like Russ Tice, William Binney, Thomas Drake, and J. Kirk Weeb, third-party contractors like Snowden and AT&T whistleblower Mark Klein, and independent journalists like James Bamford. Together, the story they tell is of a truly Orwellian society in which all communications are being captured and analyzed by the NSA and, with the advent of facilities like the new data center in Utah, presumably stored indefinitely for use at any future time in any future investigation for any pretense by anyone with authorization to access that data. According to Snowden, this includes lowly third-party contractors like himself, operating at NSA subcontractors like Booz Allen Hamilton in the vast and expanding private intelligence industry that has grown up around the information industrial complex in the exact same way as private military contractors like Blackwater formed around the military-industrial complex. In some ways, this information-industrial complex is even more insidious than its military-industrial counterpart. For all of the ills caused by the military-industrial complex, and there are many, at the very least, it required some sort of excuse to drain the American people's resources, and its failures, like the Vietnam quagmire or the debacle in Iraq, happened in the clear light of day. In the information industrial complex, where vast spying programs happen in the shadows and under the cover of national security, it takes whistleblowers and insiders willing to risk it all even to find out what is being done by these shadowy agencies and their private sector contractors. Even worse, the entire Orwellian spy grid is being run on the flimsiest of pretenses, the war on terror, that has no defined endpoint and justifies turning that spy grid inward on the American people themselves. Surely Eisenhower never envisaged the monstrosity that this information industrial complex has become, but the foresight he saw in identifying its early stages over half a century ago is remarkable. The problem is that we are even further away from heeding the warning that he delivered in that 1961 address than we were at that time.
It is the task of statesmanship to mold, to balance, and to integrate these and other forces, new and old, within the principles of our democratic system, ever aiming toward the supreme goals of our free society.
If only this was the rhetoric that was shaping today's debate on the issue, instead of the well-worn canard that we must strike a balance between freedom and security. Sadly, until such time that the National Security Act of 1947 is repealed, and the cover of national security is lifted from the dark actors that populate this sector, the information industrial complex is unlikely to be quashed, or even hampered, anytime soon.
And again, you were just listening to James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com. And I highly recommend that you check out his website and his other work. So back in November of 2017, I was shocked while watching a congressional hearing by the Senate Intelligence Committee grilling representatives of Facebook, Google, and Twitter. And essentially what they were doing was pressuring these social media companies to censor. And when you see the connections between these companies and the intelligence community, you see that this hearing was perhaps a setup to provide cover for these social media companies as they practice the massive censorship that they are now involved in. I guess my shock came from the congressmen and women throwing the Constitution out the window, not giving a hoot about free speech. But today, I just read an article indicating that they are not alone in pushing for censorship. Their supposedly democratic European nation allies are doing the same. I'm going to read parts of this article, which is titled, European Union Demands Google, Facebook Step Up Internet Censorship. And here goes. In a new attack on free speech, the European Union is calling on major social media and internet firms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Google, to automatically and immediately censor online material. On March 1st, the EU Commission called on companies and EU states to ensure, quote, the detection and removal of illegal content through reactive, so-called notice and action, or proactive measures. It also identified a vast amount of material targeted for censorship. According to the Commission, its recommendations apply to all forms of, quote, content ranging from terrorist content, incitement to hatred and violence, child sexual abuse material, counterfeit products, and copyright infringement. Quote, considering that terrorist content is most harmful in the first hours of its appearance online, all companies should remove such content within 1 hour from its referral, as a general rule, it said. The measures the EU is discussing would force companies to create programs answerable to no one to trawl the internet and delete users' content. This would consolidate censorship measures the EU proposed last year via the EU Internet Forum, which called on tech firms to work to develop automatic removal of online content. The EU hailed moves in this direction that have already taken place, according to the EU. Twitter reported that 3/4 of the 300,000 accounts removed between January and June of 2017 were deleted before posting their first tweet. According to YouTube, more than 150,000 videos have been removed since June of 2017. Once aware of a piece of terrorist content, Facebook removes 83% of subsequently uploaded copies within 1 hour of upload. The EU justified its policy with shopworm claims about the fight against terrorism. Quote, while several platforms have been removing more illegal content than ever before, we still need to react faster against terrorist propaganda and other illegal content, which is a serious threat to our citizens' security, safety, and fundamental rights, said Digital Commissioner Andrus Ansip. And on a side note here, they're using the terrorism here as a reason to practice this censorship. And we know that if you've been paying attention to this show and doing your own research, you know that we have created Al-Qaeda. First it was the Mujahideen, then Al-Qaeda morphed into ISIS. We have created, funded, and supported them along with some of our allies. So now we want to use that as a basis for censorship. But back to the article. Press accounts of the latest EU demand for censorship cited the need, as The Guardian put it, to fight, quote, extremist content on the web that, quote, has influenced lone wolf attackers who have killed people in several European cities after being radicalized. The argument that EU censorship is aimed at so-called lone wolf terrorists is a lie, above all because lone wolf terrorists are largely a political fiction.
The major terror attacks in Europe were carried out not by isolated individuals, but by members of Islamist networks active in NATO's proxy wars in the Middle East, and who were actively watched and protected for that reason by European intelligence. The organizers of terrorist attacks in France in 2015 and in Belgium in 2016 were well known to the intelligence services. The Kouachi brothers, who led the Charlie Hebdo attack, Abdelhamid Aboud, the leader of the 13 November 2015 attacks in Paris, and the El Bakroui brothers, who carried out the 22 March 16 Brussels attack, were all well known to European intelligence. They were allowed to travel freely and prepare their attacks, as their networks were intelligence assets operating under state protection. Similarly, the links of the Islamic State militia to Berlin Christmas market attacker Anis Amri and Manchester bomber Salman Abedi were also known to German and British intelligence, respectively, before they attacked. These attacks were seized on by the EU powers to intensify police state measures that shred basic democratic rights, such as the state of emergency in France. Now the red herring of the fight against, quote, lone wolf terrorists is serving as a pretext for yet further attacks on internet freedom and freedom of speech. These attacks are well advanced. The EU wants the same IT companies that work closely on internet censorship with a wide variety of states, above all Washington and the U.S. intelligence agencies, to use similar methods to trample on freedom of speech and other democratic rights in Europe. This is what emerged from recent remarks by Julian King, the EU Commissioner for Security. Quote, censorship like that being proposed by the EU, King said, is not only possible, it's being done already by a number of the larger platforms. He called for proactive measures to identify and remove illegal content, including automated means, such as upload filters, where this is appropriate. He also called on IT firms to cooperate with EU member states, trusted flaggers, and among themselves to work together and benefit from past practices. Such remarks are a warning. U.S. politicians and IT firms have openly declared that they are seeking to carry out politically targeted censorship, aiming to promote, quote, trusted news outlets that function as little more than state propaganda outlets. Above all, these censorship measures are being implemented to restrict access to socialist and anti-war publications such as the World Socialist website, amid rising opposition to war and austerity among American workers and youth. Last summer, the World Socialist website identified that a dramatic decline in its readership, together with that of other socialist, anti-war, and progressive websites, resulted from Google's implementation of a new algorithm aiming to promote authoritative news sources over alternative sources of information. Now, under the guise of fighting terrorist content, the EU is similarly seeking to implement repressive measures to censor the internet that are squarely aimed at rising social and political discontent internationally. Major European powers are already enacting similar censorship laws at the national level. Since January 1st, the German network enforcement law has been in effect, enabling Berlin to regulate and censor the internet along similar lines as the Trump administration and its attack on net neutrality in the United States. In the name of fighting, quote, illegal content, the EU aims to target any oppositional views that challenge its plans to slash social spending to finance remilitarization and wars abroad. As the German ruling elite prepares a new coalition government between the Social Democrats and Christian Democrats, the parties involved in the new government have called for strengthening the German armed forces and German influence worldwide, as well as major increases in military spending. In France, President Emmanuel Macron has announced 300 billion euros in military spending over the next 6 years, as well as calling for deep cuts in basic social programs and a return of the draft. It is in this context, amid deep popular opposition to EU austerity and militarism, amid recent strikes across Europe from German metal workers and British rail workers to Romanian auto workers, that the EU is seeking to set up the censorship of the internet and social media. And again, that was from an article called European Union Demands Google, Facebook Step Up Internet Censorship by Kumaran Ira. and it was first published on the World Socialist website, and you can also find it on globalresearch.ca. So as I see it, more and more people understand that we're being lied to about most things by our government and corporate media. So social media has become a great way to share the alternative narratives. And this is really threatening the globalist agenda for full-spectrum dominance. So, for example, within minutes of the Mandalay Bay shooting in Las Vegas last year, YouTube was full of videos by eyewitnesses, several of whom have died since posting their videos. And these videos told a very different story than what the establishment and their prostitute media were telling us. So literally millions of Americans are now aware of these false flag events. But after the recent Parkland, Florida shooting, there was a quite noticeable lack of such videos. And videos contradictory to the official story, such as some videos by Alex Jones, were removed from YouTube. Now, whatever you think of Alex Jones, I would like to have the right to hear what he has to say and judge for myself its merits. So the information industrial complex and its information war is well underway. The question now is, what are we going to do about it?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
You're listening to Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
And now teachers taking the lessons of the classrooms to the streets from West Virginia to Arizona and most recently Colorado.
I can feel the spirit building, soft as a whisper, but loud as a roar. I can
And that's exactly what we are, they are doing, led really by teachers from across the country. The victorious Wildcat strike in West Virginia ushered in a new wave of teacher and state worker activism and strikes organized by the rank and file with their unions racing to catch up. Teachers without bargaining rights in Oklahoma, Kentucky, and Arizona, where striking is illegal and their unions are weak, summoned their courage and walked off the job.
The most recent addition to this cavalcade of militancy is the Colorado teachers, who with their union, the Colorado Education Association, shut down the statewide school system for 2 days. At the same time, Arizona teachers went on strike after weeks of militant demonstrations. They are fighting years of budget cuts, which translate into low wages and benefits and inadequate school budgets.
And with us in the best tradition of May Day from the picket line, Kat Barrett, an English teacher from the Phoenix Union High School District in Arizona, and Jocelyn Palomino, a high school teacher of Mexican-American literature in Denver, Colorado. And sisters, welcome. And you are leading the way. It's most exciting, but daunting.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, we're really excited. I mean, I cannot tell you.
This is the whole country.
Really, really. And in New York and Jersey and surrounding areas, you are really breathing fire and energy and possibility into our efforts for benefits, for wages, and to service better for those of us in the service area.
That is so exciting to hear, especially from the West Coast. I can tell you, we need your support.
Well, you've got it, and you're going to tell us how we can do that concretely. But why don't we start? Let's see. I'm just going to arbitrarily say, let's go to Arizona now. Tell us what's been happening there, our dear friend.
All right. In Arizona, we are definitely doing a West Coast style walk out. We have teachers out here with tents. We have Socratic seminars happening where we're teaching teachers the budget inside where we're currently on watchdog for these legislators. We're making them work. We're making them do their job. were using social media, and it couldn't look brighter for us.
And Jocelyn, Colorado, tell us what you did last Thursday and Friday and where you are now.
Yes. So we have had huge rallies at our state capitol in Denver. Thursday, we had two districts rally. They were Douglas County and Jefferson County. And then Denver Public Schools, along with several other districts, rallied downtown. We all wore red. We all chanted. And we put the pressure on our legislatures to increase school funding. Denver right now is experiencing incredible wealth generated by the cannabis industry, and we're not seeing it in our public schools. I personally see the expansion of charter schools, but I'm not seeing our public schools, our community schools, especially schools located in neighborhoods, in communities of color. We're not seeing enough support for those schools. So we have been really vocal. And we're even, we haven't done the strike yet, but we're moving in that direction.
But you shut down the system for 2 days.
We sure did. Mass numbers of teachers took a personal day, and our superintendent, Tom Boesberg, was forced to call it a labor shortage, and he shut down the district on Friday.
You know, one of the things that, since you brought up the issue of the charter school, Kat, Jocelyn, if you could both address this, the importance, and then we're going to find out what's missing from the budget for the children of those states.
Mm-hmm.
Why continue to support? What's the importance of public school education? And then, of course, we're going to get to the wages, the benefits, the conditions of the workers, and indeed the resources for the public school system.
Mm-hmm.
Kat, why should we support public school teachers and public schools?
Go ahead.
Yeah, the public schools in West, over here in Arizona, we're seeing large migration happening. So we have school districts that are going without air conditioners, that have pest control challenges and overcrowded classrooms. We've got 40 in an English classroom. So we have a teacher trying to teach Shakespearean literature in a classroom size with 40 students. We need more reading specialists. Because as our students are being promoted in the public school system, they have a right and they deserve to have that creative freedom. And we're not seeing that happening anymore. Finally, the teachers got upset enough to say, hey, what would happen if we banded together and we started making our voices be heard? And we decided to do it.
Excellent. And from my perspective here in Denver, for me, the number one reason why we should support our public schools is because we accept all. It doesn't matter a child's linguistic skills or first language, second language, or anything that may impede the learning. We accept all children within the community, and we're not seeing this same situation with our charter schools. Our charter schools often discriminate against students who are receiving special education, and they can't adequately serve those students. So the number one reason is because we serve all students.
And Jocelyn, in Colorado, is there inadequacy of funding for the classrooms?
Absolutely. And I'm going to tell you, here at my school, I'm at Abraham Lincoln High School. And we are in the heart of a Chicano immigrant community. I have over 97% of my students. We have approximately 1,000. We started off with 3,000, nearly 3,000 15 years ago. But in relation to the charter school, our district, our school board leaders and our superintendent made the decision to place a charter school in the middle of our comprehensive high school. So we are, you know, three stories. On our second floor, we have sixth and seventh graders from a charter school that have the capacity. They're a 6 through 12 model. Compass. They're called Compass Middle School. Anyway, so they're in the middle of our high school, and we've been here since the school's been established since 1957, and then all of a sudden we have this charter school, and it feels like a cancer. Our library, it has been compromised. Our space has been compromised. You see more teachers on carts. You see many, all of us have to share a classroom. And why? To accommodate a middle school that's not even serving our students adequately. They're not doing well on standard tests. And I'm just appalled with our situation.
And Kat, talk a little bit about the, I had this vision for a moment of these students studying Shakespeare in mass, you know, just this cacophony of voices and craziness. But also talk about the conditions of the worker and the pay level of the people in the school system as well. And by the way, if you want to ask each other questions and stuff, because it looks like we're building a mighty, mighty powerful movement, which we want to facilitate, of teachers across the country who are leading the way.
Yeah, we finally feel that hashtag Red for Ed, and you'll see a lot on the Twitter and the Facebook, has built this movement for teachers to no longer be ashamed that they're sitting in class sizes with 40 to 41. Our counselors, we take work home with us. Our work does not end when the bell day, last bell rings. We're up at night making sure we have that counselor-to-student ratio in our junior and senior English classes, have those college opportunities. So we're taking the work home with us. And finally, you know, we just started this movement where we said this is nothing to be ashamed about, but we need to educate the public about. We have air conditioners falling through roofs. We have air conditioners that don't work in Arizona. We're the leading capital in solar energy. Why aren't we investing in something to bring these funds into Arizona to help our schools? We see our budget being diminished. We have old computers. We don't have iPads in our classrooms, yet we're expecting kids to be college and ready bound, and we're not equipping them with 21st century modern technology. The technology in the broadband consistently goes out in our schools. When we're mandated to take computerized tests, this creates a challenge. And yet we're graded on that letter grade, which is based into our evaluation performance for our take-home pay. So finally, the teachers have just said enough. We're going to start going out there and educating the public. And we took to it. We set up this walkout. We've got the pictures to show them. We've got the testimonials, and we want these working conditions because these are the students' learning conditions. And if we don't address those conditions, our kids are not being equipped to set up for success.
Yes, and I wanted to add that here in Denver, you know, I teach Hispanic American literature, really Mexican American studies. And I don't have enough textbooks for my students. You know, the anthologies are $40 to $50, and I have a class of 32 students, and there are not enough textbooks. I teach I have four preps. That's the other outrageous thing. I'm like two teachers, and normally we have one to two preps. In another course that I have, English 2 for sophomores, I don't have enough copies of Beloved, and you should see how ridiculous it is. I have to run down the hallway or send a student down the hallway to pick extra copies up from another teacher who has, you know, doesn't have the planning period when I'm teaching the course, and vice versa. So we don't have enough books. I'm having to buy paper, pencil. My students, I'm in a high poverty. I think I'm hovering around 97% free and reduced lunch. And teachers, bless them. They routinely buy supplies for our students. And another issue is transportation for my students. A lot of them cannot afford the busing. I think that the school should provide for that, all of our students. We just have many, 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 many issues. And the same, we're rallying. Hashtag Red for Ed. I could go on and on. I'm all fired.
Yeah, it's frustrating for the teachers when we have to spend out of pocket to buy the supplies for the classroom, because if we put in a purchase order or a requisition, it may or may not get processed. And dealing with that frustration level, teachers have just said, we're going to start educating the public, and we're going to show them what we're buying on our credit cards to put in our classroom. It's just, the working conditions have got to improve.
Yes, and
when
I wanted to add...
When a teacher doesn't show up... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I just wanted to add to that that the working conditions, you mentioned the air conditioners. We didn't even have air conditioners until the charter moved in. Once the charter moved in, suddenly our building, we were able to afford air conditioning. And additionally, I have restrooms up here for the ladies, and it's been out of order for 2 weeks. And so mm-hmm. children are having to go to the, you know, second floor, first floor, and it's just outrageous. And I believe it's something the plumbing hasn't been kept up, so the building mm-hmm. hasn't been maintained adequately. It's not right.
I recently had a Republican senator, Senator Kate Brophy McGee. I invited her to come in to the classroom and shadow me for a day so she could experience the working conditions. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time she was able to see, and I think it was a really grounding experience for her to see that the student to computer ratio we lack, the broadband and Wi-Fi going in and out, just walking the hallways, looking yes. at the staff restrooms. And we're encouraging others to get out and really connect with their legislators, their senators, and to not be embarrassed anymore, to bring them in and ask them, how do they like working bell to bell? And what do mm-hmm. they see that could be improved? And opening mm-hmm. that dialogue up is what we're doing here in Arizona. This seems to be working. We know that the students are the center of everything that we do, so we have to continue this fight for our students and our schools.
You know, I really have to compliment both of you because you've been talking here for a while about what's wrong with the system in Colorado and Arizona. And you've talked about the needs of the children for almost the entire time, and that's fantastic. We don't have too much time left, but why don't you spend a minute on yourselves and just what do you need? What about pay? What about pensions? Jocelyn?
So what are my needs in terms – I'm sorry, I didn't catch the part.
Pay
the last
and
part.
Pensions or other things that for the teachers.
Yes. So currently in Colorado, our retirement system, PERA, is subject to change because of their lack of funding for that. And the proposal is to change the retirement age. Currently it's 58. When I started 18 years ago, it was 55. And the proposal is to have folks work until they're 65 to collect retirement. The other issue, cost of living, 3% when I started out. It's 2.5 at the moment, and the proposal is to bring it down to 1.25. And the cost of living has become outrageous in Denver. I can no longer, I couldn't afford to buy a house at the school. 10 years ago at North High, where I worked, the houses were going for $400,000. Now it's about $500,000. So the cost of living has dramatically increased in Denver. Yet we're being asked to decrease that. And those are the big issues here for Denver Public Schools or for the PERA system in the state of Colorado.
Kat?
Yeah, in Arizona, before this movement started, our lawmakers would not renew our Proposition 301. And after we announced the walkout, they renewed that Prop 301. And then 1 month ago, the governor said he would only provide $65.4 million for a 2% raise. And now we've moved, hopefully, this amount to $306 million. His offer was going to sweep the funding from universities and public services that would impact our students. And now Red for Ed has forced the governor and the politicians to create more sustainable revenue sources without cutting those from our services. This K-12 budget that we're advocating for will now add an additional $4.6 million in K-12 education for Arizona. So the Red for Ed movement has created the largest increase in school funding since the recession in 2008, but it's still not going to be enough. And this budget is not going to be going far enough to meet our needs. Our fight's not over, and we're going to keep the pressure on until this budget is passed. We're going to do
yes.
this, and we're going to make history in Arizona, and we're going to make the changes that are needed for our students.
Yes, and I wanted to add one more thing. For Colorado, we have a tax structure where we cannot increase tax revenue to support our community, our public schools. So we have what you call the Tabor, and that needs voter approval before we can receive any funding. And that needs to change. And what I'm asking folks to do in Colorado is to look for a governor, a new governor, Kennedy, Kerry Kennedy, who supports the teachers, who doesn't support the current tax system that is choking our public schools. Enough is enough, and we're not taking it anymore.
Well, you're using my favorite color, red for Ed, and enough is enough, basta ya,
for
sure. In the 30 seconds, both of you, how can we support you? Let's go, Jocelyn Palomino, high school teacher of Mexican-American literature in Denver, Colorado. You first, 30 seconds, what do we do? And then Kat Barrett, English teacher from the Phoenix Union High School District in Arizona. Jocelyn?
Yes, yes. So first of all, please encourage our lawmakers in the state of Colorado to support increasing funding for public schools and support Kerry Kennedy, who is going to support our schools, and she's going to restructure the taxes. So please, I urge folks to support those two issues.
Okay, Kat.
Over in Arizona, we really need you on the hashtag Red4Ed, and that is under Twitter. Also on Twitter, if you can follow me, at ReadersLeadPD. ReadersLeadPD. We will get you hooked up with some grassroots organizers that are making this come alive. Again, we're grassroots, we're hitting the pavement, and we're educating them with our legislators, our politicians, and we're making them work for us because those are those elected positions that they're supposed to be doing.
And what a perfect way to end with the vibrancy of Kat Barrett from Arizona, Jocelyn Palomino from Colorado. Our teachers are taking the lead, and you will inspire the rest of us.
Don't know from day to day when they're going to make the decision and what the choice is.
6 days of confusion and uncertainty. Thousands of teachers across Arizona walking out of schools, but now it's back to class. Thanks for choosing us. I'm Katie Rammel.
And I'm Faye Fredericks. Governor Ducey putting pen to paper, signing an education budget deal, and now most teachers will return.
But is this actually a win for educators? ABC 15's Melissa Blasius is live at the Capitol.
Well, overall, yes. In fact, in many decades, nobody can remember seeing anything like this. Such a huge push for change with the signs and the rallies here at the state capitol. And in the end, they are walking away with a significant increase in school funding.
I've stayed up for 24 hours.
Arizona's teachers watched the education budget debate as it ran into the wee hours of the morning, and the governor signed it into law around 6 a.m.
This is historic for me.
The six-day teacher walkout, there is a feeling the overall Red for Ed movement will improve Arizona's K-12 education system.
It's just opened other people's eyes, let people see what it's really like, and that was necessary.
And to see this, I'm revived, I'm empowered.
It's an emotional moment, even for some longtime lawmakers.
I have two sisters that are teachers. They were here all week, and I don't think anyone should feel like they came down here and it wasn't worth it.
While Red for Ed did not get the legislature to replace the whole $1 billion shortfall in school funding since the recession, classroom teachers will see a 10% increase in their paychecks this fall. Other provisions include $100 million for new textbooks and other school needs, plus money to build a handful of new schools, and millions for renovation at others.
I think it is an extraordinarily significant amount of increased funding, which hopefully will make for happier teachers.
It matters that they were here, and I think that none of this would have happened if their movement hadn't started. And
so the teachers do go back to class in many school districts tomorrow, and we'll see what happens from this point forward. We do know that the legislature and the governor are promising even more big bumps in education funding over the next few years. But, of course, nothing is absolutely set in stone. Reporting live at the state capitol, Melissa Glazes, ABC 15, Arizona.
Melissa, thanks.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Way Out.
Learning how to write a really good play is a lifetime's work.
The most widely reported gay story in U.S. media this week was the outing of the star of an international television show.
Uh-oh. I am standing on the bones of a man to hide a crime.
Somehow I feel I should apologize.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell.
And I'm Greg Gordon. Thailand proposes civil unions for same-gender couples.
A severed gay Japanese widower sues his sister outlaw.
And we Oscar more radio heroes.
Those stories and more this week as we sound last call for our month-long 30th anniversary party for This Way Out.
I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Carol Myers.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending April 28, 2018. The Rights and Liberties Protection Subcommittee of Thailand's Justice Ministry announced this week that it's drafting a bill to create civil partnerships for lesbian and gay couples to be presented to the cabinet sometime in May for approval. It's not yet clear if all the rights of heterosexual marriage will be given to same-gender civil partners. Nevertheless, Liu An Vu, coordinator of the Asian region of the Global Queer Rights Group, best known by the acronym ILGA, told the London Independent newspaper that any legal recognition would be an important milestone from the government towards equal recognition in the future. It's not the first time that the Thai government has proposed a marriage equality-like bill, but all previous attempts have been unsuccessful. The last effort was interrupted by a military coup in 2014. Vu said the current effort will also promote understanding and acceptance of same-sex couples and of the wider rainbow families community. Thailand is viewed these days as one of the more progressive countries in Asia. Lawmakers there approved a measure in 2015 to protect LGBTI people from discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. Insiders say the Civil Partnerships Bill should be enacted before the next general election, which is scheduled for February 2019. It's now a race between Thailand's pending civil partnerships and the advent of marriage equality in Taiwan to see which is the first in Asia to legally recognize gay and lesbian couples. Taiwan's High Court ordered lawmakers to open civil marriage to their same-gender couples no later than May 2019.
A Japanese gay man who was denied the right to attend the cremation of his partner of 47 years and lost their shared property to the late partner's sister, including their business, sued her this week. The lawsuit, filed at the Osaka District Court, seeks the restoration of all the assets jointly owned by the man and his partner, and an additional sum equivalent to about $64,000 in damages. The unidentified man's lawsuit claims that his partner's sister knew they lived together since 1971, mostly from the money the plaintiff made through his work. The plaintiff further asserts that he had attended weddings and other ceremonial events of his partner's relatives. But that meant nothing after his partner died at the age of 75. In addition to denying him the right to attend his partner's cremation, the sister only allowed him to attend the funeral as a visitor rather than as a family member. Japan's top court has thus far refused to recognize the inheritance rights of same-gender couples or even of common law heterosexual marriages, so the lawsuit is clearly going to be an uphill battle. The man's lawyer offered a simple solution. He told the Kyoto News Service that if a same-sex marriage system is established, it would not only ensure the rights of partners but also help resolve irrational discrimination. Japan's federal government has steadfastly refused to consider marriage equality or any form of legal recognition for gay and lesbian couples.
Marriage equality and other queer rights issues have been hot topics during recent election campaigns in a number of countries. Both major candidates in Paraguay's just-concluded presidential election opposed marriage equality and the legalization of abortion. Mario Abdo Benitez of the ruling Colorado Party, the farther right of the two choices in what's considered one of the most conservative countries in Latin America, was elected on April 22nd.
One of the candidates in a snap presidential election called for May 20th in Venezuela is an evangelical pastor. On the campaign trail, Javier Bertucci has been stumping for a public vote on marriage equality. He, of course, is strongly opposed to it. Meanwhile, one of the country's leading queer advocacy groups, Venezuela Equalitaria, predicts successful outcomes of two marriage equality lawsuits that are in their final stages in the constitutional chamber of the Supreme Tribunal of Justice.
A marriage equality bill is pending in Chile's Congress. There's reportedly majority support in both houses, but recently inaugurated President Sebastián Piñera has been far from supportive. Chile is bound by the January 2018 Inter-American Court of Human Rights Marriage Equality ruling, which created binding precedent for 16 nations in the region without it that are signatories to the American Convention on Human Rights.
Lebanon's center-right Christian Democratic Union is calling for the decriminalization of same-gender sex as part of their campaign leading up to Election Day on May 6th. Party officials stressed when their 131-page platform was rolled out in mid-March that decriminalization was a crucial part of their social agenda.
And Rahul Gandhi of India's opposition National Congress Party vowed this week to finally dump the country's infamous Penal Code Section 377, a remnant of British colonial-era rule that outlaws consensual adult gay sex if his party comes to power. Meanwhile, the country's Supreme Court asked the current government for its views on Section 377 as justices prepare to hear a legal challenge to its constitutionality by high-profile 33-year-old hotel owner Keshav Suri. Prime Minister Narendra Modi's administration has consistently pushed back on attempts to overturn the law in Parliament, where there's said to now be majority support for repeal. After a roller coaster ride over the past few years of having the statute struck down, only to be resurrected on appeal, equality activists are hoping that a recent ruling by the Supreme Court establishing the right to privacy, with one justice in particular citing private consensual adult gay sex as an example, will grease the wheels for the final repeal of Section 377.
Indonesia's queer community can take a little time to breathe, as a bill to outlaw all sex outside of heterosexual marriage, which would include premarital heterosexual sex as well as consensual adult same-gender sex, was put on hold this week for another 2 to 3 months, according to a lawmaker from the ruling National Democratic Party. Consideration of the proposal, which was introduced in February, has been delayed, he said, to give the public time to provide feedback on the bill to us. All 10 parties represented in the Indonesian House are on record in support of the measure. Opponents may have to turn to the nation's Supreme Court if the bill ever becomes law. That court struck down legislation to criminalize consensual adult same-gender sex in 2016.
The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump continues to tear down as many progressive policies enacted by Barack Obama as it can. The latest assault came this week with the announcement that rules established by the former president's administration to protect transgender people from discrimination in health care are being scrapped. Under a new policy reportedly drafted by the Department of Health and Human Services, doctors, hospitals, and health insurance companies would be free to deny treatment or coverage to a person based on their gender identity. The original protections were part of the Affordable Care Act. They banned healthcare providers from discrimination based on gender identity and prevented healthcare insurers from putting arbitrary limits on trans healthcare. The real-world benefits of those provisions included making it much easier for trans people to access gender confirmation surgeries that had previously cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. A federal judge in Texas previously blocked the trans-specific protections in a challenge by a group of medical professionals, ruling that the act's ban on bias based on sex did not extend to gender identity. Trump intends to resolve the issue by dumping the contested provisions altogether.
And finally, one partner in a same-gender civil union in Italy that wants children through artificial insemination must claim to have conceived the baby through heterosexual sexual intercourse in order to be registered as the baby's legal parent. Because artificial insemination and surrogacy are illegal in Italy, infertile heterosexual couples that use either service must also lie on government forms in order to be registered as the baby's legal parents. As an article in the Daily Beast noted this week, only the biologically linked parent has the right to be listed as the child's parent under Italian law. If there is no biological link to either parent, registering the child in Italy is impossible because same-gender couples and single people cannot adopt. The online site used the case of a gay male couple from Rome to illustrate the absurdity of the situation. They married in Canada in 2009 and have three children, twins and a daughter, all born through a surrogate in Canada. Both men's names are on all three birth certificates there. But when they returned to Italy, only one of them could register as the official parent of the twins and the other as the official parent of the daughter. Queer activists placed the blame squarely at the foot of the politically powerful Roman Catholic Church, which has erected as many obstacles as it can to the happiness of Italy's queer families.
That's NewsWrap, Global Queer News with Attitude, for the week ending April 28, 2018. Written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the newly renovated thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
This Way Out's 30th anniversary celebration has been a time to get together with old friends and make some new ones.
Earlier in the month, we heard greetings from a few of the amazing volunteer feature producers who have told the stories and entertained the guests over the years.
We're speechless without them. There are many people who have filled our weekly 29 minutes with fascinating gems to send around the world to you.
Let's renew our acquaintance and honor the fine work of just a few more of them.
This is Brian Goble, and I contributed features to This Way Out for many years. And one of my favorite interviews was with the playwright Tony Kushner, a writer I really admire and look up to. It actually took me a really long time to land the interview, but he finally agreed. And in 2008, I flew to New York City. It was my first time in New York. And I was a nervous wreck, but he was a very gracious host. He had a stack of books about Lincoln on his desk because he was writing a film for Steven Spielberg at the time. And it was an incredible interview, and as I was leaving, his last words to me were, "Enjoy the city," and boy, did I enjoy New York City.
Greetings, prophet! The great work begins! The messenger has arrived!
Tony Kushner's masterpiece, Angels in America, a gay fantasia on national themes, thrust him onto the international stage in the early 90s as one of the major playwrights of his generation. The seven-hour epic in two parts is a politically and emotionally fused portrait of gay life in the 80s under Ronald Reagan. It won Kushner a Pulitzer Prize and was made into a film directed by Mike Nichols in 2003.
If people like you didn't have President Reagan to demonize, where would you be?
If he didn't have people like me to demonize, where would he be?
I visited Kushner at his tiny Manhattan office.
Anything that's worth doing is hard to do. And I think that it seems to me, at any rate, that learning how to write a really good play is a lifetime's work. And, to do something well is great, but to do something better after that and to keep improving would seem to me to be the goal of the thing. You don't want to just have done it well once. You really would like to be, you know, to have a career in a way like O'Neill's, where he, you know, got better and better and better and better until he wrote his greatest play and the greatest play any American ever wrote at the end of his life. I would like to believe that at the end of my life, I'll be able to say, well, I kept trying to figure out how to write plays and get better at them.
Tony Kushner, thank you.
Sure, my pleasure.
For This Way Out, I'm Brian Goble in New York.
You are fabulous, each and every one. And I bless you. More life. The great work begins.
The History of the Rainbow Minute, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. On February 9, 2005, Richmond gay activist Judd Proctor just happened to tune in to the new community radio station WRIR. He was delighted to discover This Way Out, a gay and lesbian news magazine in Richmond of all places. He immediately called the station to offer his support. Judd and his partner Brian Burns decided to underwrite This Way Out and had the board operator read a 30-second blurb honoring a gay or lesbian icon in history. The first was about Harvey Milk, who stressed the importance of coming out. It was read live on the air by Dustin Richardson on February 16, 2005. Blurbs remembering architect Philip Johnson and lesbian activist Barbara Giddings followed. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Sally Holsgrefe.
Who made This Way Out sing? Our queer music maestros take up the baton again in honor of their fallen friend. But first...
This Way Out would have been nearly impossible without the rock-solid journalism of the late Cindy Friedman, our news director for more than two decades.
Her skills as a news hound were without peer. But what we miss most about Cindy Friedman is her often wicked sense of humor. Here's an example from February 1999 with Cindy and co-anchor Leo Garcia.
The most widely reported gay story in U.S. media this week was the outing of the star of an international television show, which has spun off a marketing empire of best-selling videos, audio recordings, and other items. Former leader of the now-defunct Moral Majority, Jerry Falwell, has published in his National Liberty Journal this parent alert.
The sexual preference of Tinky Winky, the largest of the four Teletubbies characters on the series that airs in America on PBS stations, has been the subject of debate since the series premiered in England in 1997. The character, whose voice is obviously that of a boy, has been found carrying a purse in many episodes.
Teletubbies producers insist that the so-called purse is in fact a magic bag. Here to speak for himself is...
Pinky Winky!
Mr. Winky, would you care to comment?
Now, further evidence that the creators of the series intend for Tinky Winky to be a gay role model have surfaced. He is purple, the gay pride color, and his antenna is shaped like a triangle, the gay pride symbol.
In our reviews of some 40 mainstream press reports and columns, Falwell has been universally ridiculed. Falwell has been universally ridiculed. After 2 days of media assault, Falwell told NBC that he didn't really mean that you are gay, but that if you are, he is concerned. There are also those who maintain that, as a Teletubby, you are only vaguely human and cannot be considered to have gender attributes at all, much less a sexual orientation. Mr. Winky, I must ask you the question that has so obsessed America this week. Are you gay?
Big hug. Bye.
For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman with Leo Garcia.
Welcome back to the Audiophile 2010 Year in Review. I'm Pam Marshall.
I'm Christopher David Trentum.
I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm J.D. Doyle.
That's from the final edition of the 14-year run of Audiophile on This Way Out in December of 2010. Our monthly queer music segment brought dozens of fabulously talented outperformers to the attention of This Way Out listeners worldwide.
We asked audiophilers J.D. Doyle in Houston and Chris Wilson and Pam Marshall in Los Angeles to reflect on their longtime collaboration. They each also wanted to pay tribute to a beloved colleague and This Way Out benefactor.
What few of the listeners realized, and what made working on Audiophile both interesting and challenging, is that, no, we did not record the show at the same time or even in the same studio.
Everything became possible with a traveling laptop and sound equipment. But how did we create the proper acoustic in-studio environment at home? For the better part of our 14 years on the air, Audiophile was, in fact, recorded in the closet.
It still kind of amazes me.
By the way, all of our shows are still available on the internet at audiophile.org. Just click on Audiophile Archives, which is maintained with a searchable index by J.D. Doyle.
The producers of This Way Out asked Chris and I to each pick a favorite artist segment out of those we did. Well, that's a little like picking among your children, as over the 14-year period, we featured 424 different recordings by 325 different artists. But we did each manage to come up with just one.
Each of these artists was featured three times during the Audiophile run, so yes, we really like them. They are Janis Ian and Levi Kreiss. Janis, of course, has been an important artist since the 1960s, and Levi won a Tony Award in 2010 for the musical Million Dollar Quartet. These segments originally ran in 2004 and 2006.
I am standing on the bones of a mountain too high to climb.
You know, artists, when we're doing our job, we get to take people's dreams and make something visible out of them. And then when people forget that they have dreams and everything looks really dark and horrible, we get to remind you that they exist. And that's a serious privilege for us, you know. I feel like I stand on a lot of people's bones every time I get up on stage, and the bones of people like Billie Holiday who do that for me and continue to do it for me.
Somehow I feel I should apologize, cause I'm just a little shaken, but what's going on inside?
The second album by Levi Kreiss is called One of the Ones.
It's a collection of songs about relationships that I've been in with various guys that I've crushed on or dated or loved with all my heart. I chose to keep it very intimate, the piano and the vocals, and hoping that the human experience that I've gone through is kind of relatable for everyone.
Lovely.
I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm Pam Marshall, remembering Christopher David Trentum.
Or as we always called him, CDT.
He taught us to edit audio tape with a razor blade and keen listening skills.
He engineered many, many radio features for us, including Audiophile, eventually moving us into the 21st century with digital editing and production.
This is J.D. Doyle, and paying tribute to CDT is especially important to me. When I was invited to join Audiophile, I was fairly new at my own radio show, and what he taught me about the engineering and production part of it was invaluable and jump-started my own work. He was a picky perfectionist, and I'm sure right now he would be fussing at me for popping my peas. At times, he could be exasperating, but somehow was always right, and I am the better for knowing him.
But beyond that, he became part of our extended family, joining us for the holidays.
As well as for Pam's home-cooked meals following each Audiophile recording session.
CDT was one of the most genuinely decent people I have ever known.
And although you rarely heard him on the air, Audiophile's 14-year run would not have been possible without him.
We miss him.
We certainly do. We keep up a tribute page at ChristopherDavidTrentum.com, where you can find out more about our good friend and co-producer, who love trains, and This Way Out.
And that's it for the final edition of Audiophile.
We would like to thank the literally hundreds of GLBT musicians for sharing their music with us for the past 14 years.
And special thanks to Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle for providing us the opportunity to present Audiophile here on This Way Out.
And of course, we would very much like to thank you, our listeners, for supporting us over the years.
I'm J.D. Doyle.
I'm Chris Wilson.
I'm Pam Marshall.
And I'm Christopher David Trentum.
Thank you for listening.
Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy.
You've been listening to highlights from the work of some of This Way Out's volunteer producers over these last 30 years.
Bay Area news reporter Brian Goble is currently a bike courier, but he's just taken on a wonky research and policy job with the San Francisco Board of Supervisors.
Pam Marshall, Chris Wilson, and J.D. Doyle have all retired from radio, while their audiophile segments live on at J.D.'s QueerMusicHeritage.com website. Pam and Chris do lots of community work, including Pam on the board of their temple and Chris with bioethics organizations.
Meanwhile, JD has launched two huge websites honoring queer Texas history, HoustonLGBTHistory.org and TexasObituaryProject.org.
In addition to the feature producers, our NewsWrap volunteers have been and are a vital part of the This Way Out family.
We already paid tribute to longtime news director Cindy Friedman. Sandy Dwyer was the first to hold that position and gave birth to the saying, an informed community is a strong community.
It's news to me.
It's news to me.
There have been dozens of NewsWrap readers over the years. We thank them all with a shout-out to the current crew.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
I'm John Dyer V.
I'm Michelle Yater.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
I'm Sarah Sweeney.
I'm Christopher Gall.
I'm Frances O'Brien.
I'm Seth Eric Cutler.
I'm Carol Myers.
I'm Michael LeBeau.
I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Monique Lukens.
And so our 30th anniversary party is winding down. Be sure to visit our brand spanking new website at thiswayout.org for pictures, video, and audio highlights from our month-long celebration.
Including honorary presentations at the West Hollywood City Council and Founders Metropolitan Community Church.
To paraphrase what playwright Tony Kushner said to Brian Goble, we've kept trying to figure out how to do international LGBT radio and get better at it.
Here's to a future of queer media breaking the sound barrier.
And beyond.
Happy anniversary.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from Michael LeBeau and Carol Myers, with thanks to Brian DeShazer. We celebrated the talents this week of longtime program contributors Brian Goble, Judd Proctor, and Brian Burns, this time with Sally Holzgrief, Cindy Friedman, and J.D. Doyle, Chris Wilson, Pam Marshall, and Christopher David Trentum. Triumph, Janice Ian, Levi Christ, and the Tom Robinson Band performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music.
This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. 30th anniversary greetings are still cheerfully accepted at the all-new thiswayout.org.
Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio at aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA.
I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Lucia Chappelle. For the entire This Way Out family, we thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org.
And on KAOS Olympia, Washington.
4CCR Cairns, Queensland.
WRPI Troy, New York.
And more than 200 other stations around the world.
Including this community radio station.
Stay tuned.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. 18 years have elapsed since Michael Hart and Antonio Negri published a major work of political theory called Empire. That book, together with the two that followed, with the titles Multitude and Commonwealth, formed what's called the Empire Trilogy. Then came the volume Declaration, published in 2012, and last year saw the arrival of Hart and Negri's latest foray into debates over what social movements and the left can accomplish in the face of current systems of domination. That foray, that book, has the title Assembly. Michael Hart is a political philosopher and professor of literature based at Duke University. He also co-directs the Social Movements Lab at the John Hope Franklin Humanities Institute. When Michael joined me from a studio on the Duke campus, he began with these remarks about what prompted the writing of Assembly.
Well, this book project starts for me and Tony really with 2011 and both the enthusiasm for a variety of movements across the world, and then starting with the Arab Spring, Tunisia and Egypt, moving to Spain and Greece, finally arriving across the Atlantic with Zuccotti Park and the various forms of Occupy. And we felt like these movements were inspiring for many people, in fact, expressed the desires and aspirations for democracy of so many people, and yet we're not able to transform our societies in a more just and democratic direction. So that for us already poses a conundrum about organization and leadership, because precisely all of these movements in 2011 are called at least leaderless movements. They're in fact experimenting with new forms of organization. So that at least is an initial inspiration for us, or a need for us, it seems, to rethink questions about organization and leadership.
What did you see going on within the movements you mentioned in terms of discussions around leadership and decision making?
Well, it seemed to us within the movements themselves, there seemed to be a false choice after 2011, or you could say after 2013, because certainly Gezi Park movement is part of this. Even continuing on further, I would say that the various parts of Black Lives Matter movements, in fact, go under this too. I think within the movements, there's been a false choice between a pure horizontalism, that is a refusal of leadership and really institutional structures in all forms, or a return to older traditional forms of centralization and leadership, often in the form of some sort of party or vanguard party. And it seems to us that that's not really the choice. In that sense, the conundrum of either leaderlessness or an old-fashioned centralized form of leadership, that's what seemed to us a conundrum that had to be addressed.
Leaders of movements, when movements have leaders, are thought to have the unique ability to do the strategic planning required to advance the movement's goals. What's your take on this?
Exactly. I think we have to recognize the roles that leaders have played in revolutionary movements in the past. Leaders, single charismatic leaders, but also central committees, leadership structures, etc., to recognize the roles they have played, like you say, most importantly even for strategic planning, for decision making, and recognize how we could accomplish them otherwise. So this doesn't seem to us a refusal of leadership as such, but mechanisms for accomplishing what leadership structures have done in the past, and accomplishing that in a different way. So, for instance, both the ability to make political decisions, but also the ability to institutionalize, to make last of movement. These are at least two of the characteristics that leadership structures have been responsible for in the past.
Is there a concern on your and Antonio Negri's part that leaders, when they do strategy, when they are entrusted to do strategy or just do strategy, that there's a danger involved there, that there's something that is taken away from the masses, from the movements?
I would say that at least the last 50 years, in a variety of countries, the U.S. and really every national context, there has been a questioning, an undermining of the undemocratic nature of leadership structures. Think of it, here would be the most easily accessed example, I think, when the U.S. is think about various practices within feminist movements in the 1970s and 1980s, the insistence that everyone speaks at a meeting in various consciousness-raising formats, the refusal to allow people to speak to the media in the name of the group. These are all practices that are trying to undermine the undemocratic nature of centralized leadership structures. I think that's also gone on in anti-racist struggles, in student movements, in labor movements, in a whole variety of struggles, this questioning and even undermining of the structures of the centralized and hence undemocratic forms of leadership. So I think we have to build on and learn from where the movements are. I mean, here's another way of looking at it, if you like. This seems like a perfectly realist way of saying it, which is the movements as they are today, social movements as they are today, have created a kind of allergy to leadership structures. They're really constituted in such a way that leadership structures in their traditional form really can't take hold. So for better or for worse, you know, there are these antibodies floating around that are going to attack any leadership structure that evolves. So it seems to me not even a viable option, just being realistic, that one could try to impose traditional centralized leadership structures on the movements. What one has to do instead, this is the only realistic option, it seems to me, is to try to develop forms of organization and institution that accomplish what leadership, traditional leadership structures have done, but do it in a democratic form. That's really what I think is required.
So what are you and Mr. Negri arguing in terms of how responsibility should be allocated, ideally, between leadership structures and movements. Because you still do want, quote, leaders in some sense. You want them to do certain things. So what do you feel comfortable leaders doing and the movements in general doing?
The way Tony and I think of it is, and not as an answer, this is not a solution, this is a framework for thinking about a solution, is that there has to be an inversion of strategy and tactics, in the sense that, as you were already saying, that the traditional format in revolutionary movements and various forms of liberation movements has been that leaders have been given the responsibility of strategy, thinking in the long term, making decisions over the most important issues, seeing far, understanding the entire social field. That's strategy, and leaders have been responsible for that. Whereas the people themselves, the movement, have been responsible for tactics, localized actions, even localized decision making. What we think needs to happen is an inversion of that. That there still should be structures for leadership. There are times when we do need decisions made in a short term. Some decisions require expertise. These are things that leaders should be assigned. You know, here's the stupidest example or the easiest example. You know, any good demonstration requires that you have certain people that are not only responsible for security, but that can monitor to figure where the police have blocked off this street and we need to turn on this street, or how to stop people from being arrested, or how to get people out of jail once they are arrested. I mean, these seem to us like a kind of tactical leadership that can be assigned and dismissed for temporary means. Whereas, and this is the much harder part, whereas the multitude or the people or the movement themselves in a democratic way have to be responsible for strategy. Like I said, for making decisions over the most important questions, for making long-term plans, for assuring continuity. That's a much harder question. In fact, I would say that the majority of the book is our trying to understand and even test that the multitude could be capable of strategy. How is it that people can decide democratically over the most important political questions? How are we going to be capable of that? That's really our question. That seems to me the most important question that arises from this thinking about organization.
So Multitude, which was the name of one of your earlier books, part of the Empire Trilogy, Multitude is a word with a very specific meaning in that book. You've referred to the multitude, the movements, the people. Are you kind of bringing them all together, those terms, or is there something about the multitude which you are suggesting in this book, Assembly, is kind of the entity, the population out of which will emerge this strategy to confront the status quo? Are you saying that the multitude specifically has a role? So I guess I'm wondering what the multitude is and how to differentiate that from the masses.
Sometimes casually I use them interchangeably, the people, the movement, the multitude, the masses. But that's really only to try to just communicate with people where they are with the terms they use. Tony and I do understand multitude in a relatively specific way. But I think one that is pretty easily understand with where other people are, what we're really trying to designate is a population in struggle that includes real differences. So that would be the contrast to the notion of the people. The people is often, at least, thought of as a unity and even relatively homogeneous. Or rather, the notion of the people itself starts to function like an identity. We want rather, and it seems to us important rather, to emphasize the real differences that exist within the people in struggle, and to insist nonetheless that we can struggle together, that we can struggle in common. You know, so here's one way to approach it, if this is a vocabulary that works for you. You know, we were inspired at a certain point and learned a great deal at a certain point from the concept of intersectionality that comes really through a black feminist, U.S. black feminist origin, and then has become extremely important concept within women's studies and feminist studies. And part of what it does, I guess it's really twofold, is one is to emphasize the radical plurality of differences. Often, I suppose, in identity terms. And then the other side is the possibility or the need for coalition, you know, for a political struggle to recognize those differences and then to pose coalition. For instance, the Combahee River Collective Statement was one original point of that, let's say. So that's one way of approaching what multitude should be, is through that notion of coalition. The hesitation should be, but this is also a discussion within those who use the term intersectionality too, is that for us, multitude shouldn't be thought of as just a set of identities that then have external relations to one another. And that's the caution with any notion about coalition. But rather, multitude is a way that we can, like we would put it, I hope this can make sense, as a set of becomings, like that all of these differences are also becoming different and becoming different in struggle together. So it's not a model. I guess this is the basic thing. It's not a model that we have to be unified in order to be strong. You know, we don't have to say we're all after one thing. We all don't say we are the same, but it's finding ways to recognize the social multiplicity, social plurality, if you like, but that can nonetheless struggle in common. That's what's important to us about the concept of multitude. And I think if you look at all of the social movements around us, is really crucial and basic for activists in practice.
Michael Hart joins us on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. He teaches at Duke University, and we are talking about his latest book, co-authored with Antonio Negri. It's called Assembly. It's published by Oxford University Press. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain. Okay, so if leadership should do tactics and movements, or the multitude should do strategy, then the question is, and you posed it a bit earlier this hour, is can the multitude do strategy? How will the multitude do strategy? And this is a big discussion. It occupies a large portion of this book, Assembly, but maybe we could start with what you stress in this book about cooperation and social cooperation and existing circuits of cooperation, already existing circuits, amongst the multitude. So can we start there? Like, what do you see as kind of bringing the multitude together, despite the fact that they live in different places, they have different employers, some people don't work or can't work? What's the kind of cooperation from which you draw some encouragement?
In many senses, this question, is the multitude capable of strategy? It really overlaps strongly with a maybe more familiar question, which is, are people really capable of democracy? In other words, I don't mean, you know, can they go out and vote in elections every once in a while? What I mean is, can people collectively govern themselves, collectively make political decisions? And that's that too. It's just another way of posing what is really a quite difficult question. You have to ask what are people's capacities in their daily lives. I mean, I don't think anyone should assume that people are born and spontaneously have the ability to collectively govern themselves, to make political decisions together. So, for Tony and I, looking at people's capacities in their daily lives, for Tony and I, it does pass through a economic register, you know, through labor, but labor thought quite broadly. It's not just what people do at work, you know, like what people do for a wage. We think labor or really social production in a quite expanded frame, like how people produce social value in cooperation with each other. And in fact, it's those circuits of cooperation in social production that seemed to us one key for recognizing people's capacities for political self-rule, you know, for collective decision-making. So that leads us through quite extensive, I guess, economic analysis about capital today, how capital today primarily extracts values that are produced socially, and that analyzing the way that people produce value socially that capital subsequently extracts, that gives us a key or a lens through which to recognize people's capacities for you know, like I say, when we say for people cooperating together, creating new circuits of cooperation and social production, strongly overlaps with their capacities for making political decisions together.
Financial mechanisms and finance, you argue, have been deployed more and more by the bosses, the capitalist bosses. What impact has that had on the relationship between capitalist mechanisms of command and workers, with that term construed broadly?
Yeah, big question. But let me actually start back. I hope I can do this quickly enough for it to make sense for us. I would say, or Tony and I start from an hypothesis in a way that capital functions primarily today through extraction, through extracting values that are produced elsewhere. So you could start by thinking, and many authors do, Tony and I started this thinking with scholars and activists in Argentina, that capital functions today in large part through the extraction of oil, of minerals, even thinking of monocultural agriculture as a kind of extraction of wealth that it finds, seemingly free for the taking, an old colonialist imaginary, and extracts them from the earth. Well, in the same way, it seems to us, capital functions by extracting social values. Like, as a kind of hinge, think about the metaphor of data mining. Data mining is seemingly the same kind of extraction, like the kind of mining. Data might even sound inert, you know, the kind of data mining that Facebook does or that social media that functions through social media, et cetera. What they are, you know, data sounds inert, like it's just, I don't know, your age and height or something like that. But actually what's getting mined are forms of intelligence, social relations, things, forms of social wealth that are being produced, you know, often on social media by users, et cetera. So that might give you a key to thinking about how capital functions, say, in platform capitalism, you know, like in social media and various similar forms, Uber. Capital functions not by producing values the way it did in the factory. In other words, by organizing cooperation itself. That's the way capital functioned in the factory. But rather by extracting values that are produced by relatively autonomous social cooperation. Like, that's where we're going with this. So finance, to come back to that question, finance might be at the end of that entire line of reasoning, that finance functions, at least in large part, as a mechanism to extract values, extract and accumulate values that are produced socially outside of its direct organization. I hope that sequence made some sense.
Yeah, it does. And so when you said outside of its direct organization, are you saying that a gap has opened between finance and capitalists more generally and workers, or maybe that gap has widened in recent years?
I think it's definitely widened, but start already with the early 20th century readings of finance capital, Rudolf Hilferding, Lenin himself. One thing they posed is they were thinking of this in spatial terms, that what finance represents is a distance between the banker, the holder of financial capital, and the organization of production. So the values were being produced in the industrial context for them, early 20th century, but the profits were being accumulated at a distance by the banker. That's a similar thing. You could say that gap, like you were just pointing out exactly, that's a gap, and that gap perhaps has widened. So there are two things you could also react about that gap. On the one hand, you could be outraged, indignant at the injustice. Yes, of course. But the second thing you might think about is, at least in the context of social production, that there is a certain potential, certainly not automatic, but a potential for autonomy that's marked by that gap. I'm talking in somewhat abstract metaphorical terms here, but I hope it makes sense, because what we want to say, here's another way of getting at the same question. When Marx is writing mid-19th century about industrial production, when he talks about cooperation, for those Marxologists in the room, chapter 13 of volume 1 of Capital, when he talks about cooperation, it's the one time in the book where the capitalist has a intrinsic role. The capitalist is not a parasite, because what the capitalist is necessary for is to institute and organize cooperation, creating the site for the workers to cooperate, bringing them together, even disciplining them, forcing them to cooperate, giving them the mechanisms to cooperate, etc. So in some ways, cooperation in that context comes from above. I would say that by and large, in social cooperation today, the kind of social cooperation, the values of which are extracted by finance capital or by platform capital for finance through platform capital, cooperation primarily arises from below. And that's actually, I think, an important difference, or at least my metaphor of above and below give an idea of a possibility that could look outside of and beyond capital that is intrinsic in these forms of cooperation.
I'm C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Michael Hart is professor of literature and a political philosopher based at Duke University. He's co-author with Antonio Negri of the Empire Trilogy, consisting of the volumes Empire, Multitude, and Commonwealth. The two have also authored the book Declaration, and their latest book is Assembly. You and Antonio Negri are also interested in the kinds of knowledges that workers have access to, and in some case, the knowledges built up, let's say in relationship to machines and machine systems, that the knowledge about these things that workers have built up that may actually exceed what the bosses, what the capitalists actually have. Can you talk about that and also talk about what resources those knowledges might have for this project of developing a strategy among the multitude, by the multitude?
That's great. I think you're right that we should, one could thematize, and one should do this in many frameworks, that those below have superior knowledge. So the instance you were just mentioning is, and this has long been part of the arguments for self-management, you know, in the various self-management movements of factories in the course of the 20th century, which is that the workers do know how everything works, how to make everything. The engineer doesn't even know, and certainly the factory owner or the bosses don't know. They actually know how everything goes together in the car and how everything is made, et cetera. They have a superior knowledge, like you're saying. I mean, what do you do then with that recognition that from below one has a superior knowledge? I think that that knowledge has to be mobilized. I mean, that knowledge has to be mobilized and organized. But it's an important first recognition, because I think that our assumptions against the possibility of democracy, the assumptions against the possibility that the multitude could be capable of making decisions for a better society are so strong that it's helpful to have recognitions like that that show us the capacities that could be organized.
And I think could is the key word here, right? Because despite the fact that there are, as you say, already existing circuits of cooperation among the multitude, despite the fact that labor, if we agree with you, has achieved a certain kind of autonomy in relationship to the capitalist class, or despite the fact that workers do have more intimate knowledges of, you know, what they're working with and what they're making than the people who oversee their activities, the question is how that all comes together such that the multitude acts in a kind of a unified way, despite their differences, to actually produce strategy that can move a political project of social and political transformation, fundamental transformation, forward.
You're exactly right. And it's important with how you're emphasizing the could, because there's nothing spontaneous about this. There's nothing immediate about this. There's nothing guaranteed about this. It requires organization. But let me try another example that might just simplify these things, because I think it doesn't have to be I keep posing it at a large scale, and it might be good to start with some smaller scales. I remember being told by friends about a vote in Berlin, in the city of Berlin, a municipal vote some years ago about the electrical system. And the vote was whether to make the electric system common. So what they meant by that was, you know, pre-1989, the electric system was state-run, both east and west in Berlin. So it was public property, you know, property of the state. After 1989, the electric system was private, both east and west. In other words, like in many of the U.S. municipalities, it was electric system was run by private corporations. If we were to make it common, it would mean that the residents of Berlin would be able to make decisions about the most important aspects of it. Like, it's not like all residents of Berlin are electrical engineers. They, of course, don't know all the specifics about, you know, whatever, circuits, etc. But they know enough, and they certainly could know enough, to make decisions like, should we use nuclear energy or not? What should the pricing scales be? Should there be variable pricing for the rich and the poor? Like, these are the kinds of decisions that we could be capable of making. So that's the it's a good example, I think, because it both touches on the common, which is maybe something worth talking about, but it also shows that, you know, of course there are certain things that certain expertise, you could call it leadership in that sense, is required for. But the really important decisions, what earlier we were talking about in terms of strategy, those really important decisions don't require any greater expertise than everyone could easily attain. And that they're really political decisions about what kind of society we want. And that's the kind of thing that we can and really should develop the capacity to decide together.
Let me ask you about the common. How important is the common to you and Antonio Negri? And, you know, when people think about the commons, they think about private property being turned into something else, turned into often public property. Is the common equivalent in your analysis to public property?
Tony and I differentiate the common, well, first from private property, but also from public property, which by public property, we really mean property that is controlled by the state. So there is, of course, greater access to public property. But in the final analysis, it's really the state that decides over it, not us. I mean, what's crucial, I would say, in all of these questions about property and the common are really two factors. One is who has access, and the other is who decides. Private property is primarily characterized, even though in first-year law school courses they put it in a more sophisticated way, but I think in our vernacular, our normal way of thinking about it, private property primarily consists of the fact that there's limited access and that there's a monopoly over decision-making. That's what it means to be the owner of something. Public property, in essence, has the access is really controlled by, and the decision-making is controlled by, the state. What we want is something different, or what we think of as the common is something different, which would be an open access and democratic mechanisms of decision-making over the use. For instance, the use of a field, or the use of cultural products like music, or, you know, variety of other both material and immaterial goods, you know, the use of code. To make it common would mean that you open the access and then have some democratic structure for making decisions about it. That's what we understand by the common.
Right. And so if there is to be some kind of decision-making, some kind of collective decision-making to manage the common and our access to the common, then we need some kind of institutions. And I wonder if you believe that kind of the existing kinds of institutions we see in capitalist society fit the bill, or something more innovative and kind of more appropriate to the kinds of governance we want to establish is in order.
My instinct is often to start with social movements that are and think about institutions from there. Like, there are several social movements today. In fact, I would say it's a guiding thread in many of the most inspiring social movements today that are demanding the common, even without using that terminology. For instance, the Standing Rock protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline, they were super important in a lot of ways. The extraordinary gathering of North American tribes, the ways that environmentalists followed the lead of indigenous populations. But what really most interests me is that the objection to the pipeline was not in terms of property. You can imagine a property argument, you know, even a property argument that includes the violation of various treaties for the tribes. But it was not that, you know, you can't put this pipeline through because it's going to destroy our property, it's going to destroy our water. No, what the water protectors, some of the leaders at the Dakota Access Pipeline protests were saying at Standing Rock was that we need to regard the earth differently. In effect, we really need to regard the earth as common, not as property. Like, we need to establish a relationship of care and responsibility with the earth. It seems like the kind of thing I learned from, because, you know, they have a notion of the common in that statement in itself that goes far beyond what Tony and I were imagining, but at least gives you kind of an idea about an argument, a movement that's demanding the common and refusing the logics of private property. And then you would have to organize it. That's what, and in fact, that's what you're asking me for, is what would be the institutions that could follow on that and organize the decision-making structures required for the common. You know, here's what Tony and I say as a guide. One thing we propose as a guide is these have to be non-sovereign institutions. By non-sovereign, we don't mean not autonomous. We mean not belonging to traditions of sovereignty, which would be having to do with centralized decision-making and structures of authority, that we need to invent new institutions that can be properly democratic. That's the, in some ways, the question of the common and the question of the organization of democracy completely overlap with one another. And I guess with this too, it'd be tempting, or in such discussions, it's always tempting to ask someone, you know, like, well, how would you do this? What would you do? And one should resist. I think what the kind of theorizing that Tony and I do can contribute are kind of guidelines, conceptual guidelines. I think for the real content of it, that's why my instinct is to go to the movements. I think for the real content of it, you have to look at the kinds of practices and even institutions that people are already developing. I mean, this all goes under the motto of when someone asks you what is to be done, your first response should be, what are people already doing? And like, if you start with what people are already doing, it probably gets you much further than starting with the what is to be done.
Michael Hart, he teaches at Duke University. We're talking about his latest book, co-authored with Antonio Negri. It's called Assembly. It's published by Oxford University Press. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Michael about his book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Michael Hart is based at Duke University. He's a political philosopher and a professor of literature. He co-directs the Social Movements Lab at the John Hope Franklin Humanities Institute. And we are discussing his book, co-authored with Antonio Negri, called Assembly. Before we go on to talk about kind of concrete paths toward the new forms of governance that you advocate for in this book, I do want to kind of bring up an argument. I know it's kind of an old one, but I think listeners might be thinking along the lines of, what about kind of dead-end, low-wage workers, right? Because part of what you're doing is to emphasize the rise of cognitive labor, right? Sort of labor that is has a certain kind of expertise in relation to machines and machine systems, digitalization, communication technologies. A lot of these people are, a lot of workers are immiserated and are working in very difficult, menial jobs that doesn't allow, perhaps, and maybe you could tell me otherwise, doesn't allow for the kind of social cooperation and social production that you and Antonio Negri emphasize. So how do we think about those people not just being part of the multitude, but being part of the productive capacities, subversive capacities of the multitude as part of our group that can help strategize toward a better future?
Yeah, that's really important. I mean, I think first, and one should add to what you're saying, too, that, you know, even in the various high-tech communications industries, for every, you know, for every software programmer, there's 100 people doing click work in a room of just, you know, entering data, et cetera. So it's not as if any of these jobs are even any of these jobs are a guarantee of some sort of revolutionary capacity. I think it's important. That's two things I would say as starting points. Tony and I have resisted many of our friends, and this was starting with friends of ours in France, that were focused on recognizing the new forms of labor in terms of, you know, what they were calling cognitive labor, the formation of a cognitariat. And what we were resisting is that new forms of labor, you know, moving out of industrial assembly line, were involved just with the questions of intelligence. You know, so what we, one of the things that seemed to us to important to add to that is to also focus on affective forms of labor, which of course has a strong gendered component. You know, if one thinks about the kinds of affective labor in various of form, you know, kinds of labor that involve service, you know, flight attendants was a classic example, but it's also true, I suppose, in education, variety of waiting tables, you know, forms of work that involve, yeah, here we say construction of affects, you might call it emotional work, where a primary part of the job is actually managing people's affective lives. You know, that's what you do when you wait tables. Or what do flight attendants do? They actually have to be nice to people who are jerks to them, or they sell a kind of friendship, something like that. If one thinks about also that, just a first move of thinking about affective work in addition to what you were talking about, the cognitive notion, you know, the intellectual notion, it broadens out quite a bit. And you recognize that there, too, there's a great deal of expertise, I guess, but really it's not expertise I'm after so much. There's a great deal of already constructed networks of social cooperation. Like, that's what's going on. You know, think of, for instance, the hospice worker. You know, so the hospice worker working with someone during the last 6 months of their life. And this is also very gendered form of work. But what does that work involve? I mean, of course, there are a lot of material tasks about tending to the wounds and measuring out medication. But a large part of the work, well, is helping someone die, an amazing affective work, but also managing the networks of, you know, the family networks, of the friendship networks of the dying person. Like, this is an extraordinary capacity. Yeah, so if we would think about, you know, earlier we were talking about the pride of the industrial auto worker, that the workers themselves know how the entire system works. Here, too, this is an incredible knowledge of the ability to construct social networks. I mean, this is not some image of liberation. In some ways, it's more horrible when your abilities to love or your abilities to create affects are done for a wage. I mean, it might be worse. It might be more exploitative. I'm not saying that. But it's an enormous capacity. That's where I want. And it's in a capacity that involves the construction of networks of social cooperation. So that's one enlargement, it seems to me, not just the cognitive, but also the affective. But the other is that we should also enlarge the notion of labor or the production of value from the wage scene to also unwaged scenes of reproductive labor in the home, but also the kinds of constructions of community that happen all the time and that also involve the kinds of production of value that capital manages to capture, to extract. So if one expands it in that way, it's true, of course. I mean, I'm not singing the praises of, you know, working at 7-Eleven, like, by all means. But I do think it's important to recognize in the ways that a lot of people produce social values, even social values that are able to be captured by capital, how that involves the construction of social networks or, as we were talking about earlier, the production of circuits of cooperation. That's what, I mean, in some ways we're looking for that. I mean, it's true that some people are isolated and don't communicate with others and don't work with others in any way. I wouldn't deny that's true. But one shouldn't neglect the variety of ways that people at the paid work and also in other parts of their life construct these extraordinary social networks of cooperation. And that's what we're looking at.
There are a variety of paths that you and Antonio Negri see that potentially could lead toward a better future and a more sane and humane and just society. And since we don't have a lot of time left, I'm going to summarize each one of them. The first path that you list is called Exodus. It's withdrawing from dominant institutions and creating or trying to create an alternative outside them. And you point to prefigurative politics as an important example of this. The second is reformism, but not just reformism, antagonistic reformism, which is has as its goal a fundamental transformation of power. It's not just like tinkering around the edges and making things better for a few people. And the third path is taking power, kind of taking over and creating the institutions of a new society. And as you have said earlier, you think these institutions need to be new, non-sovereign institutions, not in the mold of institutions that have grown up and developed around sovereign forms of power. So which of these paths make the most sense to you? You don't outright reject any of them, although I could see, and I think our listeners could see that, you know, there are some contradiction. Like if you took all three or you kind of went down all three paths at the same time, there would be a bit of confusion and a lot of fragmentation. So can you share with us what path you see makes the most sense or what combination of paths make the most sense?
Tony and I are taking for granted that, you know, that readers and activists of various sorts will recognize these three. You know, they seem to us as three primary strategies that we've inherited from the movements of recent decades, and that people will not only recognize the three, but also recognize the limitations of each. You know, that of prefigurative politics, the way they sometimes, first of all, don't last. Also, it's difficult to live in that prefigurative world while in the larger society, that it comes to be drowned by the whole. This notion of antagonistic reformism, you know, which sometimes goes by the slogan of the long march through the institutions. It seems often people enter the institutions and get lost in that long march and never end up transforming them. And the third, taking power, it often ends up, you know, with a change of personnel, but the similar structures of power. So I think it does. I mean, while criticizing each of them, you could criticize each of them and say, well, OK, that's it. There's no hope. You know, we're done. I think for Tony and I, it is more like you suggested, that it only makes sense to us to think about these in conjunction. And I don't think it has to be fragmented. Like, let me give you this is a theoretical example. I probably should give you a practical one, too, but it's a theoretical one that's dear to me. So Gilles Deleuze, French philosopher I've been very fond of, he did this beautiful video documentary in which the interviewer went through the alphabet and for each letter gave him a concept that then he was supposed to respond to in French. The interviewer got to G, letter G, and gave him the concept gauche meaning left in French. And Deleuze, the philosopher, immediately responds, there is no such thing as a government of the left. What there can be is a government that gives space to the left. And I love this idea because it does give some sense of that combination, like that I think it makes sense today to take power only insofar as that power makes space available for new prefigurative experiments and is opening itself to the kinds of even antagonistic reformism within itself, so that taking power in a way of what we're calling the sovereign mold really doesn't seem to us like a path. And neither is a path, you know, like I said, either the other two alone. But the means of working in some ways simultaneously through these three strategies seems to me to make sense. So here's a practical example. At least it in parts corresponds. I have been, and I'm sure many other listeners have been, inspired by the municipal government in Barcelona, in Spain. And one of the nice things about the Barcelona en Comú is the name of the party. And one of the nice things is that it really did evolve out of the movements beginning in 2011. In some ways, the evolution of the movements, the evolution of demands of the movements came up to this electoral experiment. But it was an electoral experiment, you know, of a party that was elected in power to run the city. It was an electoral experiment that wasn't a negation of the movements. It wasn't like, you know, okay, now we have a party, you all can go home, we'll take care of things from now on. No, it's rather one that works in conjunction with the movement still existing, often in antagonistic ways. So that seems to me a practical example of thinking some conjunction among these different strategies. Yeah, that might, you know, that may, when we were first talking about them, maybe they could seem, at first glance, they could seem mutually exclusive, you know, or contradictory with one another. And that's what I'm trying to work through, you know, maybe not completely coherently, but I'm trying to work through the ways in which they can be not only compatible, but mutually reinforcing.
One thing that brings a lot of people together is general strikes. How important is a general strike or the weapon of the general strike to the possible revival of the left?
I've been super inspired in the last year by a movement that I know mostly from Argentina, but that exists for many other places in Latin America and in Italy, in Argentina, called Ni Una Menos, literally not one less, but meaning like not one more should die. It's really starting against femicides and against sexual violence. And one of the things, so it's been a mass movement against that in Argentina, you know, sometimes around March 8th, the International Women's Day, but also in other things. And one of the practices of Ni Una Menos, of this movement in Argentina, is to try to reinvent the strike, the concept of strike. And really what they've been doing in feminist collectives in different parts of society is say, what does it mean to you to strike? Like, so there's certain worker collectives of women that, you know, to what it means to them to strike is easily recognizable in the classical sense, you know, stop the workplace, stop the point of production. But there are a lot of other feminist collectives that don't, that aren't on the factory floor and are not even organized around a workplace, but they are innovating what it means to strike at a social level, you know, to stop the city, to stop the functioning of normal forms of power. Like that's what I think, that's a really important innovation. So in their case, I guess I would say either they're transforming, you know, shifting the question there about general strike, or maybe rather interpreting what general strike means in terms of social strike. Like, what does it mean to strike not against a specific workplace, even against the entire set of workplaces? That's the way the general strike had conventionally been conceived, but rather in a social frame. What does it mean to strike in that sense? And I think that's a really important organizational question. It could also flow from our earlier part of the conversation, insofar that, you know, part of the hypothesis that Tony and I have when reading contemporary forms of capital, insofar as capitalist production is today primarily social production, that involves a certain amount of analysis, but insofar as production is primarily social production, then the strike must become a social strike. It must be a strike not simply against workplaces, not even simply against capital, but on a social scale, or on capital insofar as it exists on a social scale. That's where, that, at least that's where I would orient a discussion around strike and do it through what the Argentinian feminists are doing.
Michael Hart, he teaches at Duke University. His and Antonio Negri's new book is Assembly. Michael, thank you for your work, and thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
And a brief announcement, a memorial for Richard Lichtman, a friend and cherished guest of this program, a memorial event framed as a celebration of life will take place this Sunday, May 6th at 2 p.m. at North Bray Community Church in Berkeley. The church is at 951 The Alameda in Berkeley. That's 2 p.m. this Sunday. And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. Many thanks to Erica Bridgman, who's at the controls today.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.